understanding is that that's going to be too much longer. I don't know what too much longer means, but I'm looking at the committee we have asked that before the meeting today, for some sort of guidance to be allowed for a few more minutes for the Dutch.
I think we can scarcely have Hamlet without the prince, you know what I mean? So let's that 10 minutes or so.
Is that committed in agreement? Now the suggestion is that we allow for about 10 minutes for the judge to arrive because he leads the delegation. Could somebody send that message to the judge? After 10 minutes we're going to start to go without you. We want to welcome everybody that's here today. We are going to start with the interaction with the National Council for Correctional Services. At 10:30 we will move on to the annual report of the inspecting staff for the teacher inspector, and a short session will be our own committee work. So we are going to be very strict with time, otherwise we're not going to get to our own business. As a way of welcome, we contrary to what some people think, this committee, according to the Constitution, Section 55, is mandated to exercise oversight over the national executive and any organ of state in terms of its implementation of legislation and policy. That's what informs the work of this committee. And if we take that further, we would understand that in terms of what will inform us today would be the white paper that talks about both the roles, functions, responsibilities of the judicial inspectorate and the National Commission, as well as the Act. So those are the instruments that are going to inform our interaction today with both you and the judicial inspectors. But from a context point of view with the National Commission, you know, at the beginning of the year, we identified as a committee five or six pillars that we're going to focus on. And we then identified stakeholders that we were going to engage so that at least at the committee level we have an understanding of what is it that you are expected to do, what is it that you're doing, what your challenges are, and how do you see us working together. So in the main, that is our interaction with the commission. What is it that you're about to do? What is it that you're busy with? What is it that you are supposed to be doing so that we at the committee level can understand? And it's more specific in terms of the judicial inspectors, because we're then going to be interrogating what you have done as reported in your annual report. So that is the context in which we're going to have our discussion. We will then allow for Judge Desai and his team to introduce themselves. We don't know them because we're meeting them for the first time. If they could introduce themselves and get straight into their presentation, allowing us some time to engage with the presentation. Thanks, Judge Desai.
Thank you, Stephen. I
sincerely
apologize for the late. Other functions besides the chair of the National Conference. I always take the liberty of introducing the rest of the people who are here with me. Members of the National Council, a long-standing member, the Professor Charles Sevier, who is a neurologist at the University of Africa. Father from Tulumu, an attorney from Port Elizabeth. Audrey Fawful, the legal court from Provision. And Mr. Nicobeni from Ulanga. Texas, a member of the Council, now the Acting Republic of China, and our Secretariat, according to our nickname. So, I might take the liberty right at the beginning of introducing how the Council is structured. Being structured like this for almost 2 decades, I've been on the Council. For 12 years. My colleague Charles Sevier has also been on the council about that time. It's additionally, if I may go to the structure of the council, it consists of two judges of the Island Supreme Court of High Court, and they're usually appointed in consultation with the Chief Justice. I was usually appointed about 12 years ago, and just 2 years of the Appellate Division of the Chair. I've been chair for about 10 years. We have oversee the list of public prosecutions. The current member is Shamila Bassoy, the DPP of Federal Pen. The problem regards to the understanding of the change in the country. So, in that regard, the current team have a vacancy. Then we have two members of the department above the ranks of director, appointed after consultation. Those two persons in the last 5 years have been the Boko Mateki and Simon. Then we have a member of the South African Police Service from the ranks of director, that's Deputy Commissioner Nino. Then we have a member of the Department of Health from the ranks of director, appointed the consultation of the Director General of Health. It used to be Dr. Maria Matawa, but the status of work prevented her from participating fully in the work of the council. Now she was replaced by the Swanee Nkomalo. Then we have two persons with special knowledge of the correctional service system, that's Professor Kavir, and we also have the Kipa. Then there are four more persons not in the full-time service state for members of Parliament appointed as the representatives of the public. Now that section has been changed by the new Act pertaining to operations on the 1st of October. I'll revert back to those members. We tried to create on Friday of the last 10 years to say constantly gender and gender equity, but also because the human factors which should be a national perspective, such as geographic distribution, and a few of the members of the council of the past as such. The members come from the Elizabeth, again from Moranga and others. So we tried to create over 10 years some sort of geographic distribution. I'll deal with that later. We change to the four more persons that come about because of the existence of one or more of your precepts that they have a role in the appointment of the additional members of the council. The members of the council hold office usually for periods of 5 years. I think for practical purposes, we are appointed 1 year after a new minister is appointed. And it runs until 1 year after the new minister comes to the new minister gets settled in and authorities will check the settlement and also have the opportunity to start shaping and also have an impact, an early impact for the new council to be constituted. So our current term of office expires in March next year, end of March next year, and next will be members of the council. The minister usually appoints one of the judges as chairperson. It also changes in this regard, which I thought was just elected after the information, and they change that in effect. The majority normally of the National Council constitutes a majority, I must say, that they rarely ever come to a vote to decisions that are made by consensus, not simply policy decisions, but also regards to the interest of individual cases and the typical premium type, the typical and substantial so the fiction about the chair is the cost of the casting work of one council member. Council members are not really paid, except for those who are not. Only serve as a state, in no remuneration altogether. Those in private is a nominal amount, fairly nominal amount. That's what it's saying. I mean, large the primary function of the National Council has been shifted over the years, has been to advise the minister on any policy matters when developing policy. The idea was that all the office legislation affecting correctional services should first disabled until the National Council in comment, and then sent back to the Minister to report to him. We tried to do that, but we must repeat that term of 3 to 5 years or so. Then we had parliamentary decisions were made about the matter to refer to the National Council. And it was unfortunate to those who the last 10 years, ministers have synthesized a different approach. Minister was one, because there was a significant decision in the council of comments. Other ministers did not occupy. But I think it's current actually is clear that all draft legislation must be referred to the National Council of Comments. The commissioner, who has had the privilege of working for the last 10 years, the private commissioner, council may examine any aspect of the correctional service system and refer any matter to the inspecting judge. We have not had a meeting since the judge was very supportive came available, so we have not been taken any decisions in regard to that report. But as we are meeting on Monday the 9th of November, when the court will be taken, the Monday meeting has been other matters to decide upon. Have some discussion on that before that. Having a short delay. We may take any decisions about the election. It's not a great deal of publicity for obvious reasons, but only future. Put you in the context of the chair, is that in this country, prior to the new act of the serious that come into operation in parole review. The decisions of parole were made in-house by the The introduction of the Commission of Revision and Parole Board resulted in a fast drafting of the legislation in that regard. We felt that there should be checks and balances when decisions on decisions which are essentially made by labor. And some of that concern about the revision and parole review which I chair. And it also complies in such a way as to have the key and old players in every position that are being called upon to do. The director of public prosecution that is needed to keep on that council, both a member of the department, and at least one person is a specialist on the national system. And we try to have two representatives. Popular. All the players are not always available because the news are heard on a certain basis, and because of that, we have a quorum of four. The people said, proceed with the National Council appoints the members of each meeting of the Intellectual Commission and an old review. Factors that are critical to implement because we have to decide with short notice on the parliamentary board, the function has been delegated to the high constituency of the decisions of the majority of advisory that was stated earlier as in the use of vipers, decisions are usually unanimous. We need to bring to you that the decisions of the matters that come before us are reviewed. If you are not understanding about that, matters do not come automatically to us. The simple reason is that out of the country, there are hundreds of matters decided decide to get it to the same thing as you want. It works pretty well. Basically, if you don't have some formula, some system mechanism, it will either be depending on the role that you consider it as all of us are part of it. Sometimes it could be reasons are made in a hurry, reasons that you made very short notice, it could delay expenditure for reasons, and generally isolated. In that council, it meant to meet on a quarterly basis, 4 times a year. This year in particular, we've had numerous problems. And the number of resignations from the board. In all the years, we've always had one resignation from business. And that representative has been no longer available. And there are two other members of the board. And because of that, because we lack of quarters, we've got all the quite the important problem that we're confronting is that there is currently a large number of lifers that we consider to grow. And so to obviate that in backlog, we'll be meeting twice a year now, especially after Monday and the 15th of September. It takes a lot of time to do that because we not simply have to make it appear, but we have to spend a day going through the profiles of the potential. Say 2 days or two, 20 people who are doing this difficult work. The last 12 months we've considered to grow 47 writers and about 18 faculty in the The Electrical Services Amendment Act introduces two important amendments, besides any other, to protect us directly. The current position is that we have two judges, a chair and a deputy. What has happened is this, that my third because he's not having a deputy chair tonight. Then Minister Kofana appointed Judge Jali, who then immediately went into the Jali Commission, and then went into this one. So then again, Minister Kofana is the deputy chair. And then Judge Kofana was appointed. Next is to see because of that question there is the context of the High Court. The foundation was rejected. So we found the problem that it could not take place on the priority. And so we decided the way of resolving that situation to appoint three judges rather than the chair, to get the chair, because that is always a judge ready. You not only would have to share these things in that way, but also to send more freedom to the human. Hopefully those judges will have sometimes. The other amendment is a complex one, because there are some debates which constitute an encounter. You're thinking that somebody in a full-time service is expected to be a member of the National Council. That sounds like on an interior should also be available to be appointed to the committee. There's some debate in the party. That's an issue that you would have to, you know, you would have to decide to do this. But the current situation is still ordered to pass. First of this year means that the 4-person initial members that are appointed in consultation with the work of the party. The structure of the National Council. In emphasize one important aspect of the work we do. That is, we decide which person is about 21 years in prison and then place after all, whether people think it's likely. That's an enormously active and difficult mark, but the obvious implication is the wrong person. But that has done that, maybe you think that it would be a good idea for the last of several hours. There have been numerous challenges, of course, in our courtroom, but the situation remains that if a lifer, any lifer, after the table before us, we make a recommendation to the ministry, and then make the final decision. I want to take this opportunity to thank members of my conference, especially their total response upon themselves. It has some consequences to the situation in regard to that. I've done it now for 10 more years. The system, I must say, that works. Following the different parts of the world. The collective decision making that we do, the representatives of different parts of the country, different writing systems, often preloading, and it has an impact on the decision making. I think that's an important and valuable role that is being controlled by the National Council. If there was any question,
thank you very much. We will open up for comments from members, but let me kick off by saying, when we started this meeting, we deliberately indicated that our role is informed and authorized by the Constitution. Our role as Parliament. And that mandate says that we must ensure that legislation is implemented. Now, that you indicated that, well, first of all, the law says that the minister must refer draft legislation, must. I'm sure lawyers are very clear that must is there's no option when it says must. What is concerning me, Judge, is you're saying that some ministers did, some ministers didn't do it. That is a problem. If I understood you correctly, that is a problem for me. When the law is flouted because of personal preferences, whatever it might be, it's a problem. So maybe you need to clarify if that is in fact the case. How have you dealt with it, if that was the case? The second one, from my side, you know, you spoke about life, and it says the minister must refer, or when taking the decision in terms of person that was sentenced, the minister in consultation with the National Council must consider whether the person is placed under parole. The question that I'm asking you is, has there been any instances where people have been placed under parole that qualify for this clause that have not received consultation from the minister? In other words, has the minister placed any lifers on parole without consulting? If the law says they must. So those two that you must clarify for us, and just clarify those things, but we need to have stakeholders when we need them.
Thank you very much, Steve. That question is a simple one. No person has been released, no life that has been released. The National Council needs to stop it. We have been instances in the past for 7 years when the legislation releases people dying, and the minister then reported the urgency and the house making a motion. That's the other difference. wasn't obliged to do that. No decision. The current situation, though, is that up to a few years, up to a year or two ago, our decisions were followed by the for the last few years, certain decisions have been completely different. The ministry is very different. They did not follow our recommendations. The matter was referred back to us. One matter was for consideration. And the other matter was the matter of Mr. Mokodema. It came back to us. We dealt with it really very thoroughly. But there is no person that is to be advanced by our having in itself. There's one problem though that keeps emerging. It emerges simply in context, where a lot of people are going to court. There's some idea that the court can be. The court is set in a clear position. It's a peculiar process. Somebody took our case. And so the reason for that is very simple. There are these in-house lawyers who are taking prison, who are participating in the detention. And they're creating a lot of confusion. But I think the law is settling down now, and the court judges are becoming aware of the vision that sells for a functional. I must emphasize that the lease of license is a very, very serious thing. It's serious because a man has committed murder based for mayhem on a serious case. And that despite having served 20 or 30 years in jail, he's still capable of real thinking. And the subjective decision that has been made, if we do that, we do not predict it. It's difficult to adjust it in your own to make it easy. What our life experience, all 20 of us, from cyber background, and the decision we make to 30 or 30. That's a very important, difficult function. The other question you asked, let's say that hasn't happened yet. We haven't had the code. We haven't had any policy yet. So we're very glad. I'm fucking example of this essential one is that the issue of privacy has never. We were never given that. It was never the first option. I'm not agreeing or disagreeing with the proposition of the draft privacy. Ultimately, it may be political. But from a policy perspective, we certainly would have liked to make an input on that. And we're not given that. That matter was never set down before us. And they even emphasize that that. We haven't made a decision, it doesn't mean that the decision is wrong. That's another decision. But we are certainly like an issue like that. We're certainly like to make a decision. Simply for the simple reason that those of us familiar with correctional systems around the world know the currency codes in other countries in the world and the legitimacy of the private system. There are good faults in that. There are positive. But the issue, because of the soft implications to the country as a whole, is an issue that must be discussed and debated in the open forum, particularly in forum where people with some expertise in the management of the actual system. I say that the primary reason that it can be very possible here, but it's debated in major countries in the world where they are completely skeptical.
Yeah, thanks, Doug. Let's open up for questions, comments, engagement. see Mr. Self, Mr. Vedasa, Mr. Phipps, do you want to say something? Let's talk to Mr. Self, followed by Mr. Vedasa and Mr. Phipps.
Thank you very much, Chair, and thank you, Mr. Judge, for the input. I really have two questions. The first concerns another section of the new Act relating to the incarceration framework, which in terms of the Act has to be referred to the National Council. And I was wondering whether the judge could give us an update as to what progress has been made to the development of that incarceration framework. The second one really relates to the Correctional Supervision and Parole Review Board. And I heard the judge say that there's no automatic review, and I understand the reasons for that. But there's also a very important aspect in my view that parole needs to be credible, and in order for it to be credible, it needs to be consistent. So you might find that yourself in a situation, we heard the parole boards earlier this year, where one parole board gives one decision, another parole board gives another decision, there's inconsistency and it undermines the credibility of parole as a whole. And this was, taken in the most visible sense by a person who was terminally ill in the other sense of the word. That decision was so patently and self-evidently unlawful, because the person concerned was not terminally ill. I think it just undermined the credibility of the entire parole system, but there was nothing that I, as a public representative, could do about that, because there was no access to the one body that could have dealt with the issue of the credibility of that decision. And I think it's a real problem, and I was wondering if the judge had a view about how we could overcome that particular problem going forward. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Self, for the very after the incarceration framework, there is a incarceration framework document available. It is presented to representatives of the various stakeholders. It's been refined. It comes back then into operation on the 1st of October, but the incarceration framework is not yet in operation. It has to be finally approved by the National Council and has to go to the Commissioner of the Independent Authority. It's essentially beneficial. I can say that the principal feature of the incarceration framework is simply this, that say the exceptional person every offender is required to serve 1 half of the sentence. And then it may be considered for the changes the position, earlier position, is considered after serving 1/3 of the sentence. On the other hand, the system earlier act is dealt with 1 half of the sentence. So it's considered for after 1 half of the sentence. So we've developed that, under what conditions it is required to serve a greater portion of the time. The advantage of the incarceration framework and in this legislation is simply this, that it's some consistency to when and how you become available from the house. There has to be buy-in, not simply from the various role boards that are going to have to get support, but also other role players who tend to what I'd like to do is make that available to everybody with the incarceration framework. So everybody knows when and how and when, what circumstances any offender is entitled to the system. The next question asked by the staff is a very important one. I can see immediately that the credibility of the parole system has taken a role. By far less than I am in terms of that, there's nothing I can do as chair of the parole review board. I let power to give it to the executive judge. The problem with that is that the one person is the least. The executive judge really has no say, so he looks after the welfare of the executive. Among the others, he looks after the serving of the executive judge. That's essentially the function of the executive judge, look after the welfare of the executive. But on the other hand, I don't see why he has the most experienced given and independent. It's not the fault of the minister, it's just that the lawyers and various others have now to experience and think we should have a certain matter of urgency. In exceptional situations, there is a distinction to make either the chair of the parole review board or the National Council of Parole to decide on the review of the petition made. Except for the one example that we're fighting, it doesn't mean that other instances that inconsistency will be there. Because inconsistency will be there. Because you all have different ages, you all have different backgrounds, all have different types. And the decisions to release one offender from the other which depends on a diverse set of factors. So it's consistent to some extent, but inconsistent from person to person because the diversity of factors is shown to be. What we try to do is that my time is specific to do this offline. We try to write some review judgments which are available to all boards and they can follow the principles set out there. What we were hoping to do in this understanding of the parole. Very often the problems arise because people don't understand why somebody has a bad part of the need or has a need. Look at the classic case of the CNA. There was no decision made by the parole board that was wrong. The court had placed it on the sentence of the threshold of the religion, which is high. That means that the one who is the receptor is entitled. That decision didn't lie with the spiritual decisions at all. The court made it. So that sort of misunderstanding is created in this passage. So that is to avoid the situation, the misunderstanding is created. It's the understanding of the system. The parole system is an important adjunct to the criminal justice system at all. We go with it. I mean, sometimes in the world are talking away with doing away with it all the time. But if we stay with the system as well, we must defend the credibility in all the policy.
That
must
Madata,
Madata, Madata,
Madata,
Madata,
Madata, Madata, and Mr. Fitz, and then we're going to afford you an opportunity to respond if you need to say it. That's the fact. Madata.
Yes. Thank you very much, Judge. Following on the last question, someone who is doing the committee, it strikes me that when I look at this document, which describes the function and the structure of the committee, is that really, besides the issue of review, it looks like you have an ongoing responsibility to monitor the correctional system, if correct is wrong. Whether it's working properly or not, which includes the system of parole as conducted by the parole board. Now, if that is the case, you have alluded to the fact that there are time constraints for the council. then my question is whether you're satisfied given those circumstances, the enormous responsibility that I read from this document, that you are able to discharge your functions as entities in terms of monitoring the entire system of collection, if it's working properly. And in this regard, I have in mind the issue of which came through when we were having hearings with the parole, that actually there is a huge problem as to their function, both in terms of decisions and the constitution of the as by the law. So, in some way, there is a similarity, that's the way you are constituted, the way the parole board are constituted, except that they are judging in the system. But there is an attempt to improve the entire judicial system in the process of counting and of the parole board. Now, it came through in those hearings that, in fact, part of the problem for the parole board not to work properly is that they rely absolutely on the proper capturing of information, right through from the court process up to the correctional center, which then requires the cooperation of the police in the records that the policeman keeps that come through the court process, the way the indictments are written by judicial officers, that came through very strong. The parole board, the parole like this, it seemed to us that in many instances the judicial officers are not aware that the way they write those judgments has a huge impact on the parole. And that they got there for the writing in particular, that it was helpful to the correction. So, therefore, in summary, I'm saying it looks to me that part of your responsibility is just to look into those things and find corrective measures. In other words, having discussions with the heads of court and so on, so that these matters are brought to the attention of the senior police, so that everybody cooperates to make this work. Looks like to me the council has that kind of system. Now I'm wondering if by time constraints or also time efforts, whether they are able to do this on a continuous functional evaluation of this system.
Thank you.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
My question almost links to what Mr. Madaza is asking. I just want to make a comment on, I think 47 licenses has been suspended for a year, for a period of a year. And I think, as you mentioned, the complexity of intervention, I don't think it's incredibly impressive in the context that seems that the committee is basically almost an ad hoc committee. The 18 review matters from parole, from the township, come from different parole boards. I would just like to know around that, whether there are any serious concerns around those kind of matters that we go with, any kind of very, very serious concerns around those 18 matters. And then I want to ask whether there are any, what kind of remedies would you propose to streamline the operational kind of
regularly for other reasons as well, besides the 4 times a year. We do have problems with increasing intensity of the earth and so on. Currently, in excess of 10% of the population now 20 years in the death penalty of Saudi Arabia. So that increasing numbers of lifers completed 20 years and 25 years will come up into this situation. I foresee that in the future, 4 or 5 years from now, even 30 years back, the worst way we do may actually become a full-time occupation. But having said that, I must immediately add that I virtually communicate to the past 3 ministers on a weekly or monthly basis. For all sorts of matters that I have to deal with on an urgent basis. It's almost part of my life for the last 10 years. The Iraq, the review system has still not certain problems. Especially the Madasa also asked. It is not correct that we similar to the CSTB. The CSTBs are constituted from lay people. We are not lay people. There are 4 or 5 public representatives that are very senior. Our body is composed of experts in the field. For the first of the years, there's been knowledge and understanding of 20 odd years. It's important that in the regional board managers put up as a good owner of an attorney for the day I was born. So it's a field, it's a field of experts, and over the years we've had different people in Parliament. But both of you are right that there are problems with regard to the parole review board. I think the important point to note is that the parole review board is their first term. The people serving as parole CSPBs are serving their first term. We've learned from that experience. And their terms are often expired between 3 and 5 years. And we now have a clear picture of the sort of person who wants to point to the parole review board. One of the important problems that we, one of the significant problems we've encountered, is that not all chairpersons like career reasons. The important functioning of the parole is not to put the release of the offender, but to give reasons why you release, or to give reasons why not to release. And the matter then comes on the review to us. Those reviews, those reasons are not often set out succinctly enough. But the problem is this, we have to balance between a board which is representative, which can identify when the offender is confronted with, and a board which is there, which is sufficiently listed to write the review. We have to strike the balance. We have to get people who are supposed to understand the circumstances on which offenders come. And on the other hand, a squishy listen to the right reason. So we have some experience in that now. We hope to give guidance to that in the immediate future. If we have more time, we will certainly do that. But I will certainly urge that you speak out on the criteria to be employed and the level of advertising that must take place for chairpersons and members of the role board are appointed. Very often when I involve almost in day-to-day basis on correctional service matters. But only a year afterwards, if somebody has a vacancy and somebody has appointed, people ask me that they could be chairperson. I said, please apply to make vacancy, looks like a perfectly capable candidate. And one doesn't often hear of these answers, but doesn't know how they're appointed. I think at least there should be in an open society, that there should be more openness about the process in which parole board chairs are appointed, parole board members are appointed, that we get the best possible people. They are highly paid for the retired people, it's a fairly well paid occupation. Many people who go for that job. I don't understand how we don't get the best possible people to do that. It's going to become very important because we have to do something about streamlining our prison population. And an important aspect of that is the community, the normal chairs in that prison. So we need to be like, I guess probably with the shop.
Chair, one thing the judge mentioned about we've been taken to court quite often these last few months and years, and it's becoming a big problem for us. Especially in one case, one of the judges was very clear when in an obiter dictum he stated very clearly that the law, the Act on Correctional Services, is a very, very bad piece of legislation. in the days to come, we will have to do something very, very urgently about the whole act. And maybe as an academic, I think we have to rewrite it. The sooner the better. Otherwise, we are in for big, big, big trouble.
The same question.
That's one issue we left out. I wanted to hear whether you are speaking to the chef. That's the way you write the record, the way you write the record. Apparently, it's part of the record.
Thank you, that's a really important aspect. Unfortunately, we don't get the comments on sentence. Maybe even in my place, very often the reasons that disappeared. 20 years ago, when a guy was sentenced, reasons were given and they were never transcribed. So that is a problem. I'm glad you raised it because we wish to urge judicial structure. In any case where there are long term sentences imposed, that the same reasons of sentence be transcribed and be placed on the file of the offender so that we can have some insight. The circumstances we get to the university in that. We don't want it that way. We aren't at liberty to speak to judicial officers. I went around the country last year, both members of the speak to all the other role players. In any case, magistrates, we attend the judges here. And we try to get some cohesion in sentence. But we try to get cohesion, we try to alert them to the problems which these areas have encountered as a result of overpopulation, alternative and so on. I think you're right that matter needs urgent attention. But you know, judges don't like to be spoken to by other judges. Unless it's a superior court. But let me just say this, that I share your concern, because it impacts on two levels. I emphasize time and time again. That's an individual. I read the would like to make a decision to release a writer. I rest with the comfort of having Charles and Audrey and so on behind me to consider this. But we now have judges at the side that they can, a single person, with no experience of the connection to the defender. That creates an outcome. That brings an outcome. I think we should emphasize that the release of an offender is a societal. Not a judicial decision, because impact on society as well.
Ms. Barbara?
Okay, thank you. I'm going to
turn up. Sorry. Chair, I just want to ask Professor Sandhya, the comment that he has made, does the act in terms of the words expressed by the judge, require merely some tinkering, or does it require a complete overhaul? If you could just give us a take on that.
Before you do that, because that was the question that I was going to ask and take advantage of the presence of the acting commission. It worries me tremendously when those comments come up. Again, I want to say that ours is not a joke. We are supposed to implement a law informed by the Constitution. If this law is as bad as you are making us believe, if it is as bad as you're making us believe, Parliament put 13 billion rand aside for the implementation of this law. 13 billion rand aside for the implementation of a law that is not worth the paper that is written on it. I'm hearing what you say. Ms. Reiner, is this the first time you're hearing about this? If it's not the first time that you're hearing about it, do you agree with the judge, and what is it that we need to do before we even consider the next budget? But I'll allow that to maybe clarify, because you started the debate, and then Ms. Schreiner, just to comment on the comment of your colleague.
professor Leo Baxter tonight, which came up in one of the cases. I don't think this fact needs to pick it. I think you need to look at it in the entire picture. There's not a portion blame there. The act had to be changed from time to time, the social conditions changed. It had to be changed because we changed from 20 years to 25 years of life. That led to loopholes being exploited, that led to cases. As the cases emerged, it appeared that the sections of the Act were not gelling together. The Act has been changed from time to time since 1993 version. And I think what we need to do now is to look at comprehensively look at the Act again and redo it. And I think if we have that as a project, it will be a 12-month project, if not longer, where the Act is up. Which means looking at all aspects of the Act. The issue of the issue raised by the itself in regards to powers to review by the parole review board, and the other powers to review, and other issues that arise from regard to license, are issues which will have to be dealt with somewhere or the other. And I think this Act needs to be streamlined. We last looked at it in the 1990s as a whole. And I think Bashar would agree with me that that is the
indeed, we have already initiated the process of doing precisely that. There are a number of elements to it. One is the way in which the Act was written at the time, in the absence of any white paper providing strategic direction, and I think that the Act has flaws as a result of that process. In addition, there's been a number of different policy developments in other departments that impact on our role, and we have anomalies between, for example, issues in the health environment and what is said in our Act that we would need to be able to address. When we had amended the Act in terms of the white paper to align those two processes, we had flagged for the Digital Study Committee that that process would be followed by a major review. And indeed, it's not a one-year. It is going to require a substantial amount of work. We have, in the last month, initiated a process from tasking the boss that leads on it to constitute an internal team that will start the process of identifying what the different elements of the Act are that will need a review. And obviously that will have to be done in consultation with the National Council in terms of the legislation and obviously being brought back to the Portfolio Committee.
Do we have an indication of time as to when this massive exercise not be concluded, but when we can begin to see tangible results so that we can engage the rest of South Africa? Today, as you were saying, Chapter 5, a major part of our work is a societal challenge, not a challenge of the Minister of Correctional Services, or it's society that must take ownership of this. And the sooner society is afforded an opportunity to engage with this, the better. So, Ms. Schreiner, in terms of time frame, we don't want to put you under any pressure, but we can't have a situation where our term comes and goes and we sit at the same time. When do we get some indication that there is a product from the department?
Chairperson, at this stage we have asked the branch concerned to conceptualize the task team and the process and to bring that back to us in our next management meeting in the next month. From that we should be able to give you a better sense of the timeline for the actual project. But I think that that's the science correct. This is not a one-year process, but it's certainly something that we can't afford as a department. We can't afford to have going on ad nauseam. It's in our interest to be able to really drive it, and we are hoping to use the rest of the financial year to really start the process assertively. But I think part of what we would commit ourselves to is within the next month or so to bring back to you a timeline in relation to how that process would unfold.
Thank you very much. I think at the committee level we're going to have to now that you've heard this, I'm more concerned with the fact that there are these changes that are going to happen that are necessary. And yet there's work that needs to be done in the meantime. We need to ensure that we don't invest too much in what we're doing in the meantime if it's going to change in the future. So I think it's a very delicate balancing act. And members, we're going to have to decide how we to ensure that these two processes continue without one compromising the other one. Justice, are you, let me just check if any members have any comments and you close the interaction with us. Are there any further comments that members would like to direct to the...
That curious, and I'm looking at the other people who are going to present after me. Is there any relationship between your company and the inspectorate? Is there any overlap? Any thoughts about how to work together or to improve the... I know it's not just a comment about other people.
Yes, sir. Thanks for that.
Sorry, Judge. Mr. Ndaka, and then you will respond to them and you close as well. Mr. Ndaka?
Thank you, Chairperson. It's just a clarity. As we know that Mr. Kambembe was appointed, I just want you to clarify further about Herman Attenis. I don't know whether I heard you wrongly, but that was Herman Attenis to us, due to what.
She wasn't able to attend on each occasion because she had commitments in the court. Court appointments, she could not attend, so that's the problem. In any case, she's no longer available now because she's been appointed to the Constitutional Court. But our options now are simply this. There is to appoint somebody in the short term or wait till the whole council is reconstituted in March. We have many vacancies, and I think we should simply wait for March to reconstitute the whole committee to the best thing to do. It's a question of 4 months, and we can manage for 4 months without new council. The judge has to be a judge either the Supreme Court of Appeal or the High Court. Judge Kambembe is now a member of the Constitutional Court. So I have spoken to that answer. The other issue raised by Mr. The relationship yet. Judge Fagan has attended all our meetings, and we haven't been able to arrange to that yet to confirm, but I'm sure he'll attend our meetings whenever he has an opportunity to do so. Our meetings have largely in the last year been directed to getting certain matters off the ground rather than policy matters. And I'm sure when we discuss policy matters, we'll make sure that Judge Fagan is able to. The one matter that has not been raised and has to be done as a matter of urgency, independent of the review of the whole legislation, is the issue of the release of medical grounds. We are busy working on that, and we should have a draft before the end of this year. The importance of that is simply this, that we discovered over the last year or two that there is a lacuna in the act. There is no medical ground, besides the terms of the year. And that can't be right. It's not consistent with the best practice throughout the world. So, and certainly, it goes against the sense of any notion of justice. What we're developing now, we're busy developing, the policy, not simply a policy, but legislation, with regard to the circumstances under which people get released on medical grounds. But there are problems with regard to that. I don't want to begin the discussion of the legislation. But we have to balance one between to avoid any form of corruption on the one hand, and on the other, to let a genuinely new person go. We have to strike a balance, find mechanisms in place to protect the abuse of the system. And that's what we're busy doing now. We have some idea how to go ahead, and before the end of the year, we have to have a discussion. What we propose doing is this, and I've discussed this with the minister. That once the paper is ready, we'll convene a meeting of all the role players, present that and hear the input. So we get buy-in from everybody with regard to the new medical role.
Thank you very much, Judge, and your team. I think we're better informed in terms of what these issues are supposed to be doing, and we brought it to our attention that the urgent need for fixing up this act, which for me is probably the most important revelation of today's speech, as to how, when, who, and why we will engage as the committee and engage with the necessary people. But thanks for bringing that to our attention. We certainly will take it very seriously. We are going to interact with the judicial inspectors that will have a 3-minute body break so that we can allow for movement and for that team to come to the fore. And we will continue with the judicial inspectors in exactly 3 minutes. Thanks. There is tea outside, please enjoy some tea outside. Fortunately, that we were here when we made our opening remarks, and they become more and more relevant the more we learn in this commission. They become more and more relevant. Our role is to implement legislation and to oversee the implementation of legislation to improve service delivery. And in reading the white paper, or looking at the white paper, chapter 14, it indicates that the correctional system in South Africa should be subject to independent inspection. That's what the white paper says. Independent inspection. The Act defines your duty, amongst others, as that of reporting on the treatment of offenders in prison, reporting on any corrupt or dishonest practice in prison. Section 90 of the Act defines that as part of your duty. So again, as members of Parliament, when we prepare, we don't prepare in vacuum. We look at what is the directive from the Constitution, what are the directives of the Act, what are the directives from the governing party or government policy. Those are the things that inform our engagement with any stakeholder. And we thought we must bring that to your attention, that the instruments that we will be using in this instance would be, amongst others, the Constitution, the white paper, and the Corrections Act. And those give us an indication of what your roles are going to be. We're hoping that we've looked at the annual report. We want to have a vigorous engagement as we did at the department. We had a no-holds-barred interaction with the department yesterday. Hopefully we'll do the same because members are prepared. And for you then to respond so that we are able to write the report in terms of our own observation. The way we'll do it, that would be for you to take us through whatever it is you want to take us through with your team. But that we'd rather have more time having an engagement rather than getting a briefing from yourself. So we would give you time. I think we have until 12:30 finished. So we have just over an hour and 45 minutes. So if we could have at least an hour to engage with your report. So we'll afford you an opportunity to do the presentation. We'll open up to members for interaction. And by 12:30 or so, we would hopefully wrap up on the matter. Having said that, Judge, the floor is yours. I don't know if your team needs introduction. We've met them before, I think, but if needs be, you can introduce your team.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Yes, I think it would be a good idea just to introduce the team to you first. On my left-hand side, immediately left, is Mr. Gideon Morris, the director of the Judicial Inspectorate. He has been, and he's in fact the only member here who has been involved with the Inspectorate since its inception in 1998. He was there with the first inspecting judge, Judge Trengove, and then has been through a number of changes of inspecting judge since that time, with myself being the most recent one. Next to him is Mr. Umesh Raghavan, who is the acting manager of the legal services unit. It was a services unit which for a certain period we had fallen almost into disuse, but has become far more active, and at the present time is playing a very important role, not just relating to mandatory reports, but also relating to certain other legal aspects arising from our functions. Then next to him is Mr. Michael, is Ms. Rubel. She is, in fact, this Vida Rubel is an area coordinator. The important thing about Ms. Rubel is she has also been what was then known as an independent prison visitor. They are now known as independent correctional center visitors, but I prefer simply to refer to them as independent visitors. They have independent contractual relationships with the inspectorate, and they do incredibly important work. In fact, they are the heartbeat of the judicial inspectorate. Without them, we couldn't be functioning properly. Then next to Mr. Bobo, we have, that's Mr. Adam Carlson. He's in fact recently been appointed as the head of the Northern Region, with head office in Centurion, our satellite office in Centurion. He's known there as the Regional Manager, Northern Region. And then right at the end, you see Mr. Michael Poussaint, who's our Regional Manager of the Southern Region. In other words, the whole country is divided into two regions, and the one deals with the upper side, the northern side, and the other with the southerly. Those are our members. I myself have been involved as on the previous two occasions that I've been privileged to be here in your committee. Since the 1st of May 2008, initially as an acting inspecting judge, until I was appointed by President Motlanthe on the 1st of November for a three-year period. So I have in fact been the inspecting judge since the 1st of November, previous to that, just the acting, and I've been appointed until the end of October 2011. The important part is, one would think that after something like 18 months in this job, you know all about it. Well, that's not quite correct. You don't. There's a huge amount that we have to do. But fortunately, we have people like Mr. Morris who are there to give guidance and have, in fact, been doing just that. I've also been receiving a lot of guidance from Mr. Morris and from the other members, and I think we are moving in the right direction. May I just at the outset, lest I forget it, I don't agree with great respect with my learned brother when he says the whole act has to be rewritten. I know that it was suggested. I've gone through the act, and it may well be that there are sections and portions of it which require reconsideration, but it's not, as far as I can see, it shouldn't be necessary to have to replace the act with another Correction Services Act. What I do think must happen is that the terminology in the amended act, in other words, the act which was amended by Act 25 of 2008, should be brought in line with other legislation such as the Criminal Procedure Act, because you use, in the amended act, terminology is used such as correctional centers as opposed to prisons, inmates as opposed to prisoners, which is not the same terminology as you'll find in other legislation. And that can cause confusion. So I would like to see either the Criminal Procedure Act which be amended to make provision for that, or some other amendment will have to be made to have some kind of consistency in relevant legislation. I'm just mentioning that opera. Now, this is my first report. And you'll probably notice it's a bit later than the other reports. The reasons being, we had a change of government in April. That meant that role players changed and the whole situation changed. Also, we were not sure when the new amended act was going to come into operation. It should initially have come into operation on the 1st of April. It didn't. It was postponed a number of times until eventually we were told, and this is what happened, in fact, the 1st of October. and it has now become law. That has had a very, very important effect. Now, I'm not going to speak about all the important effects of the legislation, because I have a whole team here at my side, each of whom is going to give you a short resume of the most salient aspects on which we believe should be focused. But the important thing is, where we are a reporting body, an oversight body, we have to a certain extent a similar function to that of this portfolio committee. And in that regard, we find it a very, very important amendment that we must also make. We must also place every report we place before the minister, also before yourself, before your committee, which means that nothing which is reported to the minister is not also reported to Parliament. At the same time, I might mention, because the deputy minister has been delegated the authority to work directly with the judicial inspectorate, as was the case under the previous minister also, we make sure that the reports are made available to the minister and deputy minister, but also, and that's our arrangement this morning with Ms. Schreiner, to the accounting officer. Ms. Schreiner, as acting national commissioner in her capacity as accounting officer, will also be receiving direct reports. We hope to and plan to present monthly reports. We don't want to inundate your office and that of the minister, deputy minister, and the national commissioner with every little report that comes to us from an inspector or an area commissioner, a coordinator somewhere up in the field. But every month we hope to present you with a bulletin, you can call it, relating to all the matters which have come to our attention and with which we have dealt over the past month. Obviously, if anything urgent comes up, that will be dealt with urgently. And you will get a separate report on that kind of thing in between times. Now, I take it that everybody has had the opportunity of reading the report. The whole idea is not to read it, to go through it again, but simply to point out what we believe are the most salient issues. Would you like me? I shall deal mainly with the aspects, the legal aspects, but there will also be aspects dealt with by my other colleagues. Shall we take them through the whole lot, and then you can start with questions, right? The first thing I'd like to point out is in my foreword, which is somewhat longer than the forewords of my predecessors, for the simple reason that I had to try and understand this job properly. And to understand the job, you must understand the relevant legislation applicable. Now, you cannot understand this job, and you cannot understand the Correctional Services Act without knowing the Constitution, because the Constitution is so basic to the Act and its implementation, because what are we doing? We are supervising, we are ensuring that human rights of all persons, including every person who is an inmate in any correctional centre, are in fact protected. That's the first thing. And in addition to that, we have the white paper. The white paper, originally there was a 95 white paper, and then the 2005 white paper, which is 98. And the 2005 white paper is a brilliant document. And I'm really grateful that you've made reference to it. But one of the difficulties we have, and I'm saying this just in general terms, is that as the situation now is in many, if not in most of our correctional centres, the white paper is still just a pipe dream. Very little is really being done to achieve what the white paper has set out to do. The white paper has said we are looking at changing from retributive justice, where you take vengeance on an offender, to restorative justice, where restoration apologize. I had it on silent, but apparently not silent when you're next to the microphone. The whole idea of the white paper is, instead of retribution, you're looking at restoration. You're looking at the victim, you're looking at the community, and what you're also trying to do is, you want to really rehabilitate every single person who comes into a prison, and you want to make sure that that person can be reintegrated into the community. So those are really the basic principles as I see it. Now, of course, that means that the whole system in your correctional centres must be reapproached. It must be reconsidered. You must have programs, and those rehabilitation programs must be put into effect. Now, the impression that we have is that certain of the centres, excellent programs, at many, many others, virtually nothing. What we do hear is that there is a kind of a pre-release program which is supposed to take months, and suddenly we tell the pre-release program which takes place in days rather than weeks or months. Now, that kind of thing is totally unacceptable. But it does happen. We realize, of course, that that this is a slow process. It's not something that just happens. And it depends on your infrastructure. It depends on the money which is available. But you, for instance, you have educational possibility, but your education isn't always up to standard. In certain cases, it's excellent. In other cases, it's not. That's just generally speaking. What I've done in my foreword has been to look at those basic principles emanating from the Correctional Services Act on the one hand, against the background of the Constitution, and where necessary, also the Criminal Procedure Act, because the whole system comes into operation from the moment somebody is arrested. And you will see that, as in previous cases, as in previous annual reports, we concentrate on the fact and we focus very strongly on the fact that we have hopelessly overcrowded correctional centres, hopelessly overcrowded, with a few exceptions here and there. I mean, it's wonderful to be able to say Flagstaff has got 31 people, and it's not anywhere near overcrowded. Cockstack is nowhere near overcrowded. In fact, it has room for many more. But then you have a place like Johannesburg Medium B, Medium A and B, which are something like about 250% overcrowded. It's an impossible situation. You know, and how you can ever consider that people can be held under those circumstances, detained in humane conditions which are consonant with the Constitution, it's virtually impossible. It can't be done. So there is a huge amount of work that must be done. And I'm sure that it can be done, but provided that the authorities who have the power to do so can, in fact, make sure that ensure that some of the recommendations that we're going to put before them are done. Now, we can't tell the Department of Correctional Service how to do its job. That's also not our function. But what we can do is just make suggestions and recommendations as to how certain of the problems we have encountered can be addressed. Now, the whole question of simply building more prisons, whether they be public-private partnerships, or whether they are, whether they are going to be ordinary national centres, as the vast majority of the others. We only have two private prisons in the country. Is irrelevant. The fact of the matter is, the answer is not building more prisons. The answer is making the best use of what you have, and making use of the systems and procedures which you have at your disposal to try and deal with our question of overcrowding. I had a conference in Pretoria on Monday, dealing with role players there, attorneys who want to become involved pro bono to assist in, for instance, cases where we have something like 8,000 people who cannot pay bail. They've been granted bail, but why are they being kept in a prison? Why are they being detained? Because when the magistrate interrogated them, they created the impression that they could pay the bail, they or their families or their friends. months and months go by and the bail isn't paid and they are still incarcerated. It costs the state, it costs the taxpayer 200 grand a day to keep a single person there. And the bail is sometimes 2, 3, 4, 500 grand, 1,000 grand. Tiny amounts. Now that is something which must be addressed. There should be no person incarcerated or detained in any centre who has been granted bail. And if you grant bail with a view to keeping the person there because you don't believe he or she can pay the bail, then your agenda when you grant that bail is a totally despicable one. Because then quite clearly you didn't intend to grant bail. So I must accept the good faith of a judicial officer who grants bail that he or she believes this person doesn't have to be incarcerated or detained. That's the first thing. There are people who are arrested for really very, very minor offences. I'm not talking about people who do repeated offences. I'm talking about minor offences. We are looking at the possibility of plea bargaining. Now, plea bargaining in terms of Section 105A of the Criminal Procedure Act is something which could divert people from prisons, and of course that would also address the overcrowding issue, at a very early stage, right there and then, just after their arrest. But it's not being used properly. That's where the attorneys and counsel, and we've also been thinking of retired magistrates, retired lawyers, who can assist in that regard. Those are the kinds of things. All these matters, Mr. Chairperson, are dealt with in our annual report. I have dealt with, and I'm not going to repeat what's already here, is, as I say, the statutory background, to what extent we see and interpret our function. The function is a very limited one in terms of the Act, namely to report on treatment of prisoners or correct or inmates and to report on conditions in centres. But that second one, which goes very widely, and I have been interpreting it, maybe I'll be pulled up on that one at some stage, but I've been giving it a wide interpretation. Anything that is part and parcel of the management of a centre, which is not regular, as far as I'm concerned, as far as our office is concerned, has relevance for the conditions applicable to that particular centre. And if we have to report on conditions in the centre, we are going to look at things like poor management. We're going to look at things like irregularities being committed by members against offenders and vice versa. And to what extent? People escaping is another aspect. But not too much. It's one of our problems which we raised on a previous occasion. We're not spending enough on rehabilitation and on trying to reintegrate people. We're spending too much on security and so forth. Those are all aspects which my colleagues will be dealing with. May I then ask, the first chapter which deals with the whole condition of or the state of our correctional centres will be dealt with by Mr. Morris.
Thank you, Judge. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and all members of the committee. If I can draw your attention to page 50 of the annual report that's before you. It deals with the state of our correctional centres, and I just wish to draw your attention to maybe at the bottom of page 15 first is the good news, where you'll find there that statistically our female prison population is one of the smallest in the world, 2.2% compared to most of the Commonwealth countries, such as Canada with 9%, Australia with 7%, USA with also about 7%. And also, Mr. Chair, we have seen that there's a sustainable reduction in the number of females, with them having come down from just over 4,500 or 4,200 to its current levels of about 3,600. And as I said, if you look at the graph, this is a sustainable long-term reduction in the number of females. Furthermore, this, as listed on the bottom of page 15 and the top of page 16, you'll also see, Mr. Chair, that the effect of long sentences has not yet impacted on our female prison population, where we have only about 46% of our females serving a sentence of longer than 5 years, opposed to 67% of the male offenders. So there is a bit of a discrepancy there, but as I said, one can probably look at this as a good news. Going to the issue, Mr. Chair, basically of overcrowding itself, we have listed there in the table the 19 most overcrowded correctional centres in the country. And we believe that, Mr. Chair, that these have now reached a point where we one could probably classify them as being critically overcrowded. And what we say by critically overcrowded, having inspected those prisons, it's clear that there is no compliance with the Constitution, Section 35. People are kept in those prisons, definitely not under humane conditions. Places like Johannesburg, as the judge said, and we use this because this is probably the worst overcrowded prison, not only in percentage, but in actual numbers, where the facility was built to accommodate 2,600 people. The lockup is just now about 6,500 people. The measles outbreak that we've seen recently, Mr. Chair, we believe that these are red flags going up, and we believe that the department should be called on to put in an emergency plan on how these places are going to be run, whether that would be the interim allocation of additional resources, specifically, for instance, medical staff. Johannesburg Prison, Mr. Chair, we still receive daily reports from our IPVs that inmates don't have eating utensils, that they eat with disused phone cards. And these things it's systemic, it's going on for some time. So we're very concerned about those 19 critically overcrowded centres. Then also we know, Mr. Chair, that 49 centres are occupied at levels below the 100. It's also maybe possible to shift around some people. And then 107 correctional centres are occupied at levels between 100 and 150, and the other 62 between 150 and 200. Mr. Chair, we've said much about overcrowding over the last 2 years, and I'm not going to repeat all of it, but I would just like to draw the attention of the honourable members of the committee to two aspects there. The first one is that at the basis of the matter of overcrowding is the mathematical calculation as to the capacity of a prison. Now, let's say, for instance, if we have a prison with an area this size, what will happen is the department will use a floor space norm of 3.5 square meters to calculate the capacity of this facility. Now, we are also concerned that floor space norm of 3.5 square meters is based on a calculation more than 25 years old, and it was still done when inmates were requested to sleep on the floor. So we're asking that there may be time that we do it, that an audit be done between the actual bed space, because in the meantime they've put in the beds, and in some cases double beds, and as some of the IPVs refer to scaffolding, where they actually place three beds on top of another, and that is also an area of concern. We would like the department to redetermine the capacity based on what is a reasonable number of beds that can go into that facility. Then the second issue that I just want to highlight, Mr. Chair, that's on page 19, the graph. It's a behavior over time graph that we've put in there, and you'll see the red line, Mr. Chair, is the actual number of inmates incarcerated, and that graph goes back to 1965. So it's a very long time that we can look at the trend of what's happening, and then the blue line is the actual capacity, meaning the number of spaces that the department provides for. And what we're trying to say there is that overcrowding per se is nothing new. It's been going on since 1965. Correctional services in South Africa, and also as highlighted in the recent publication by Professor Jeremy Sarkar, it's worldwide is a problem. Correctional overcrowding is a worldwide problem. But what we also want to raise your attention to is that if you look at this graph in about 1998, you'll see that the red line rose sharply. And that was due to the unprecedented and unexpected increase in the number of awaiting trial inmates. If I can use exact figures, for instance, in April 1997, we had only 21,000 awaiting trial prisoners. In the year 2000, which was 3 years later, we had 64,000 awaiting trial prisoners. So during that time, there can be no question that the level of overcrowding was driven by one variable, namely the sharp increase in the number of unsentenced inmates. But on the second page, Mr. Chair, we've also now made a zero-based growth analysis of the unsentenced numbers, just to show to you that you can see that during 1996, 97, 99, 98, the unsentenced population was growing at a rate of about 20% per year. Of course, there's accumulation, and that's why the numbers went up. But then since the year 2000, in actual fact, for the years 2001 to 2006, we saw a negative growth rate, where the numbers came down from 64,000 to about 42,000. So, but still the prison population continued to increase. So what we're saying now, and that is the rationale for our argument, to say that the biggest threat facing prison overcrowding now is the long sentences, minimum sentence legislation. Now again, it's very difficult at this early time to give much statistical information, but if I can just use those that we have. For instance, the number of life sentences. The Honourable Judge Desai spoke about the effect of life sentences and the difficulties of the parole boards. Now, we are also very concerned about it because we can see this, that the number of life sentences has increased by more than 1,000% over the last 9 years, like having gone up from 793 to its current level of almost 9,000. Now, these are 9,000 people that's going to be there on average for the next 25 years. So if you look at all these new prisons that we are building now, they've been, in case of all, in theory, already been booked for the next 25 years. I'm saying this right after you. Mr. Chair, but then also the last, the two firegrams that we indicate on page 20, that's also to demonstrate how the composition of our centers prison population has changed. With the red part of that pie diagram, that's the terminology that they use, representing the number of people serving more than 5 years. And there we see that that went up from 49% in 1998 to 67% in 2009. So clearly, the length of the sentence that people serving is going to create major problems in the next 3 to 5 years. Mr. Chair, my last point on this chapter of the report is then the recommendation made on page 21 in terms of developing a forecast model. Now, Judge Jali also, in his final report to the President, highlighted the need for the Department to develop forecast models in how they can predict the growth in prison numbers. Now, we know that with the forecast number model, there's no exact science. But what we're arguing, if we look at, for instance, what Judge Desai said about the change in parole rules, that definitely is going to have an impact on the long-term, medium to long-term, on our prison numbers. So also, Mr. Chair, the announcement by the Minister of Finance on the appointment of 20,000 additional police members, surely that's going to impact in the next 3 or 4 years on the number of prisoners that we have. And so I'm also especially considering that in the medium-term expenditure framework, government has set aside 8.2 billion rand on building more prisons. So what we're saying is that we need to base those decisions on a scientific forecasting model, looking at all these variables so that we have a better ability to proactively predict the prison population and also then opposed to just being on a reactive fire brigade management approach to that. It's also interesting to see, Mr. Chair, that there seems to be on the face value of it, and I'm very careful saying this, that there's no alignment with the places where the new prisons is going to be built versus the 19 most overcrowded facilities. And one of the major problems we have, inmates complaining about not being close to their families. Mr. Chair, that concludes chapter one.
Thank you. Mr. Two is the prevention of human rights violations, and Mr. Raga will take us through that briefly.
Thank you, Judge. Chairperson and members of the committee. I'm going to be very brief, and we will ask some questions after my brief presentation. I'll our general mandate, as everybody knows, is the oversight of correctional services, treatment conditions of inmates. One of our strategic objectives is the prevention of human rights violations or violations of human rights. As Chairperson said, our framework is governed by the Bill of Rights and the Act, the white paper, and also importantly, Chairperson said, in a prison environment, are the so-called B orders. Those are the orders issued by the Commissioner. Now, the so-called mandatory reports, I think, like everybody knows, every correctional head of center must report a death, a segregation, a mechanical restraint, and recently the use of force. I'm going to touch on very quickly and return to page 23 of our annual report. First, we deal with the deaths in our correctional center, in our center. We make the statement there that, at the last paragraph, during the calendar year, 1 January 2008 to 31 December, there was a discrepancy between the number of deaths reported by the department as opposed to our report. The process of reconciling them is at an advanced stage, Chairperson. And what we've instituted, what we've done, we requested that independent prison visitors via an audit on the ground to corroborate the report by the department versus our estimate. The conclusion to that report, or the fact that it is reaching an end and shortly can be made by the board. If we turn over to page 2, one of our findings is that the classification of death, either as natural or unnatural, appears to be problematic, or is problematic. As we indicated there, whilst the medical practitioner is the person on the ground that certifies whether a death is a result of natural, in other words, of a normal disease process or unnatural, we certify the death. We say this carefully without impugning the integrity of each individual medical officer. It seems to be when we study the documentation which we see, the particular form that a medical practitioner had to complete, which is called the G362 form. It's a localized form that the department uses, where the medical officer would have to indicate to the medical opinion whether the death was by natural cause. Now that's the broad classification. If you look at that form, and you look at the Department of Home Affairs, for example, the importance of proper statistics, because death, not just the overall broad cause of it, but the underlying cause of death are very different. What gave rise to the ultimate natural death? And one would say the form. You will see that medical officers are enjoined to complete that. Our study of those forms is the so-called G362, which is the department form, and the BI-1668. I just mentioned this so you can jot it down and you can make it further. You'll see that medical practitioners, as I have indicated, are enjoined not just to the broad self definition of the form. What the inspector is saying that a little more attention needs to be given to the completing of those records, and the importance of that, of course, will take into account underlying causes, so the process will then be informed that if a person died, for example, of multiple organ failure, we can't argue, we say it is a natural death. But what are the underlying causes? What type of medical treatment have you received prior to that? And of course, we can't do this for 2,000, but we should be protected with this. When we take the fourth dimension, in a day, we will make those kind of comments. Now, flowing from that, it seems to us that custodial debt, and during the calendar year under review, we have 66 unnatural debt. In the classic version, unnatural debt. They would obviously be subject to a post-mortem, a medical legal inquest, and some scientific basis, reward mechanism basis for speaking to the cause of this. What we are saying is that it might be feasible for prison custodial debt for all of them to be subject to a post-mortem where little more can be said with regard to the actual cause of death at the end. So, and at the last paragraph under on page 24, that would obviously speak to the Inquest Act being looked at, and maybe some kind of amendment to the Inquest Act to include prison custody with subject to one post-mortem examination and two compulsory formal inquest. As you know, inquest is probably the best fact gathering exercise which we like over about 97% to make it to the I'm not going to speak about medical parole, which is at the bottom of page 24, moving on to page 25. At page 26, I think we said enough about unnatural death. The rest of the so-called mandatory reports, I'm just going to touch on one aspect is the Correctional Services Amendment Act, which came into operation on the 1st of October, now includes a mandatory report from a head of center on any use of force. Since the operation of that provision, we haven't received any reports. Our electronic system, of course, in which we see the general segregation reports, mechanical restraints, classification, etc., needs to be modified for that, of course, and that is the I would leave it there. I think you're going to be able to get some time to answer questions. Thank you.
Thank you. We ask Mr. Michael Crescent, the regional manager of our North and Southern region, to discuss Chapter 3 briefly.
Thank you, Judge. Good afternoon, Chairperson, honorable members. Dealing with inmates' complaints is a very important aspect of our work that we do. But in mentioning that is that we, as the Office of the Inspecting Judge, primarily rely on the report that we receive from the independent visitors. So I'll be speaking around that. In fact, in the opening remarks of the chairperson did mention about the treatment of inmates and the conditions inside the prison themselves. And much of the reports that we would receive at the office would be reports received from independent visitors. By definition and guidance by the Act, the independent visitors would be community persons of integrity, of honesty, and we would be using that as a way of trying to identify them. According to the Act, in terms of Section 92 of the Act itself, it does give the judge a statutory mandate to publicly call for nominations inside the communities. And then that goes, how we do it basically is that we would use the current independent visitors to identify for the office who are the organizations that are existing in that community. We would then, with the assistance of the independent visitors, basically then invite those organizations to a public meeting, and at that public meeting, we would then basically explain the office itself, the mandate of the office, what we do at the office, and then also then invite nominations from the organization. I can say that the majority of the people that we have appointed as from the 31st of March 2009, they are altogether 191 at that time. They were basically people who have been nominated by organizations, community organizations. basically, what we try to do as an office is to try to move to a situation where we would like the whole process of calling for nomination to be community-driven. Because our experience in the past has been that it takes some time to fill those vacancies. So more and more, if you go to second section 94 of the Act, it speaks about the visitors committee. So we would have been basically making use of all those visitors committees to assist us in identifying people who would be able to deal with prisoners' complaints and so forth. In terms of the arrangement with our office, they enter into a 3-year contractual agreement with the judge. So what I would basically say is that the process for quality nomination is an ongoing process. I would be leaving it at that because my colleague basically would be speaking for us about what exactly and how this will be completed.
That'll be Mr.
Hu.
Thank you, sir, and thank you
for the
question. I'm going to do a presentation about dealing with complaints in 2004. The Office of Inspection Judge appointed the Independent Correctional Center Director to deal with complaints by visiting the center regularly, by interviewing the inmates in private, and also by making sure that the complaints are recorded in an official diary, and also by monitoring the manner in which they have been dealt with, and also by discussing the complaints with the head of prisoners to with the aim of resolving the issues internally. And also, if the complaints are still unresolved, then the independent visitors are taking the complaints and table in the visitors' committee meeting to be dealt with. And also the last paragraph on page 35. During 2008, the independent visitors paid a total of 7,120 visits to correctional centers. And also they interviewed 344,257 inmates and recorded a total of 69,415 private consultations with inmates that were dissatisfied with the resolution of their complaints made by head of correctional centers. In page 56, we are having a statistic of complaints that are reported to the Office of Inspection Judge. In the statistics, we are having more complaints about transfers and also more complaints about communication with family, and also more complaints about bail and legal representatives.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, Honourable Members. We ask Mr. Carl to discuss community involvement, which is Chapter 4 of the report.
Chairperson and Honourable Members, as the judge said, that Chapter 4 deals with a report on community involvement. Reference to Section 92(1) of the Act that deals with the appointment of independent visitors, emphasis are laid on publicly calling for nominations and also consulting with community organizations for the appointment of independent visitors for correctional centers. Then, two of our strategic objectives of the judicial inspectors is to promote and facilitate community involvement in correctional matters, and as well as to inform public opinion about conditions in correctional centers and the treatment of inmates. The judicial inspectors promote community involvement in three spheres. Firstly, the visitors committee. Secondly, stakeholder meeting, and thirdly, the judiciary as a role player. I will only repeat very briefly on visitors committees and on stakeholders, and the judge will then reflect on the judiciary as a role player. Visitor committees, at a previous session with the portfolio committee earlier this year, we dealt with Section 94(1). Section 94(2) and 3, the establishment, the frequency of meetings, the functions, and the composition of visitors committees respectively. And today we want to basically build on that and say that for the report in review, the judicial inspectorate promoted the idea of visitors committees encouraging firstly individual independent visitors to serve as a bridge between offenders and the broader community. As Mr. Pushent has reported that all independent visitors are recommended for, from various organizations, we then encourage them to stay involved in that organization and to bring that organization on board in terms of correctional matters. So the individual person, the contractor, the independent visitor plays a very, very important role in terms of community involvement. Then secondly, the judicial inspectors also promote the idea of visitors committee, encouraging the visitors committee as a whole, as a body, to become involved in community matters where we promote correctional matters, and especially inviting structured community organizations from all spheres of life to partner in correctional matters. This is being referred to as stakeholder meetings. Brings me to my second and last point. The stakeholder meetings, each visitors committee in a particular area are requested to hold at least one stakeholder meeting per quarter. Stakeholders meeting refers to government departments that has direct interest and influence in terms of correctional matters, faith-based organizations, community NGOs, welfare-based organizations. However, one concern is that through the stakeholder meetings, we promote the idea that these organizations become involved in correctional matters. But the three concerns that we have found through the stakeholder meetings is that the accreditation process by GCS to allow them in the center and to support and help with the rehabilitation, that seems to be at this stage a major problem. Secondly, also many and most of these NGOs and organizations work without any government funding or any other funding, and DCS does not contribute in terms of funding, helping them, especially when it comes to rehabilitation programs. Now, why is this a concern is because when we look at one of the departments of correctional services limitations in terms of members, we just done a recent inspection at Cranthorpe with a population of 1,500 inmates, with one social worker promoting rehabilitation programs. We see the importance of this organization, so that is a concern. And then the last and also final comment is the requirement to conduct research in correctional center also discourages the importance of this process in order to enhance and see where we need to focus on. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Honourable members, just on the question of the judiciary, you'll see that that is dealt with page 42-43 of the report. Two words, literally. The judiciary have the power, and there I speak of judiciary from the Constitutional Court all the way down, and every magistrate, which would include regional magistrates, magistrates in the court in their own jurisdictional area, judges anywhere in the country, have the right to visit correctional centres. Very, very few of them do. You know, there are more than 200 judges in the country, and I can tell you there are only about three judges who are on a regular basis giving us reports about their inspections of certain correctional centres. I don't want to mention names, but that is really a very disappointing situation. I'm hoping that I'm going to be able to have some contact from with the new Chief Justice and with the various judge presidents to try and persuade the judges once again to visit the prisons. Department of Justice, it seems, has told the magistrates they shouldn't be visiting prisons. Now, I think if that is the case, I'm very concerned about that. We have no jurisdiction, and we can, of course, ask the Department of Justice to reconsider that situation. But it would appear that virtually no magistrates are visiting any of the correctional centres in their area. So that, despite the fact that they are fully empowered to do so in terms of the Act. Thank you very much. The last three chapters will be dealt with briefly by Mr. Morris.
Chair, I undertake not to spend more than 3 to 5 minutes on these chapters. Just chapter 5, it deals with the far-reaching changes introduced to the legislative mandate and the structure of the Judicial Inspectorate by the Correctional Services Amendment Act, Act 25 of 2008. Mr. Chair, we followed the rules of system design, looking specifically at the Judicial Inspectorate as an integrated human work system. The process that we followed is we made a detailed analysis of the Amendment Act and identified those sections that will impact on our work, and that is listed on page 46 and 47. We then took those amendments and we looked at them from three distinct different perspectives, namely organizational efficiency. In other words, we looked at how this was going to affect our efficiency. We looked at the cost implications thereof, and we also looked at service delivery challenges that will come up as a result of these changes to the Act. And then also, Mr. Chair, we used a 2x2 matrix, looking at the two variables, namely the impact on the organization and the urgency of the amendments to be implemented, and you'll see that on page 50. Now, Mr. Chair, if you look at, for instance, on page 50, that matrix that we've compiled there, on your right-hand top corner, those are the amendments that we are ourselves still uncertain about, and that's why they're listed in blue. So we need to get clarity in our process of implementing. And amongst that, Mr. Chair, you'll see the matter that you raised in dealing with corruption. Because the mandate to deal with corruption was taken away from Section 85, which stipulates the objective of the Judicial Inspectorate. Initially, it was placed in Act 111 of 1998. Then it was removed in the Amendment Act of 2000. And now, again, it wasn't put back, but it was kept in the side of the judge. So we ourselves uncertain as to what our responsibilities are there. There also, of course, on the right-hand side, those areas in red, those are the areas that we hope to move with immediately in terms of the implementation of the Act, amongst others, the changes to the e-system. I'm not going to give more detail. We will deal with that in the questions. The second chapter, Mr. Chair, chapter 6, deals with the financial analysis of the budget of the correctional services. We've made this presentation before the committee before. It's just three areas that we want to highlight. Is, of course, the rate of the increase of the correctional services budget. We are very concerned that this rate of increase is not sustainable, especially considering the current economic recession, as well as the challenges facing our tax collection, as well as the pressures under which our GDP is standing currently. Then also, we are concerned still that there seems to be little consideration given, although there is improvements, to the mandate of the department as stipulated in Section 3.2b, namely that they must achieve self-sufficiency and run according to business principles. And then lastly, also the concern that the funds are not yet distributed in line with those objectives that you stated in the white paper. Then lastly, Mr. Chair, Chapter 6 deals with the Judicial Inspectorate as an organization. At the bottom of it, you'll see there we've stated our mandate, vision, and objectives. Now, you'll see that we haven't stated the mission. Now, what we have done, Mr. Chair, we accept as a statutory body that our mission is stipulated in the Act directly. And in order to make sure that whatever we do is anchored in the Act, that we stay anchored to that core objective, we've accepted Section 85. as our mission statement. Our vision is to ensure that all inmates are detained under humane conditions, treated with human dignity, and prepared for integration. Strategic objectives, we have got six there, Mr. Chair. I'm not going to repeat them. If needed, please, we can come back to them. And then just on page 58, we need to mention that we have only 63 posts on the parcel. That's our staffing complement. It's permanent members. Then we have another six people on contact, and we have then, of course, our independent prison visitors. For the year, Mr. Chair, we have paid no overtime to any of our members of staff, and the total per capita cost amounts to 159,000 for our members of staff and 28,000 per annum for the IPVs who are paid at a rate of 55.7. That is an area of concern because the Amendment Act has left a gap in terms of who determines the salary of IPVs. And we are in discussions with the National Commissioner and the Minister's Office to get that dealt with. Important, Mr. Chair, just the disciplinary action taken amongst our own staff. During the year, six independent prison visitors were dismissed, or independent visitors were dismissed on grounds of misconduct, which include fraud and dishonesty. Then 10 of them were terminated because of poor performance. Two of them resigned for health reasons, and amongst our own staff, we had four received written warnings, and one received a final written warning, and one member of staff was suspended without pay for 1 month as a disciplinary process. Our total budget, Mr. Chair, is just over 15 million. I thank you.
Very much, Mr. Chairperson, and members, honourable members, that brings our presentation to an end.
Thank you very much, Doug and your team. Quarter to 12, we've got 45 minutes of engagement with the report and the presentation. Are there any members that want to engage?
Thank you, Dad, and the team for the presentation. Starting from your vision, I think personally I don't have a problem with your interpretation of your vision. The judge indicated that maybe my stretch is too far to place a lot of emphasis on the condition of prisons. I think it's quite clear from the law that the treatment, the report on treatment is linked to the condition. So I think that's very important that we keep it in mind. And I think one of the presenters actually made the point when he was talking about the issue of natural and unnatural causes. The link that it goes through. Because as he was saying, that it could be that the so-called natural causes actually unnatural because of the condition. So I'm thinking that that link, I think, is important, not only for you, for all of us, to actually keep it there. Therefore, following on that, flowing from that, I'd like to ask the judge whether he is happy or confident that your institution has the capacity both in human terms and in its own condition to actually prevent as far as possible, cause where we still have a problem here of overpopulation, but to prevent the abuse of human rights, or at least to secure the rights of the inmates and to ensure that they live in human condition. Are you happy that you have capacity? And what would be your recommendation? The next and the last issue for now is the matter that you touched on when you commented for the second time, the issue of the judiciary. I am concerned about that. I also, as you were here, I raised it with the other presenters. And this also leads to the past. You remarked that you tried to talk to certain people, they did have not the court. And my sense is that up to now, there is no sense of an inclusive judicial approach as to how we treat the matters of judge. That still, this department is still separate from the Department of Justice and Police in operation, the way we operate. I mean, if you still have to plead, kind of make an appointment, you can see the head of the court in certain issues. In my view, I think we need to reach that point where, as a matter of fact, all these issues are managed at the same time, inclusive. And that's due to the budget. I mean, you know that the ever-increasing budget, for example, for the Department of Police, but is it correct to interpret that budget as the budget of police, not as the budget of the class? I think that for me that's the issue. That's the budget of the police only, so that they can flood this department with inmates and then they discharge their function. Is that correct to interpret it like that? Or is it means that the entire cluster has not discharged its function, it's just only arrested, but not connected to the inmates and brought them back. So I think if we still operate in this compartment, it's quite clear from the presentation and from our general observation that we have not internalized the fact that we need to operate this system. What is the role of the judicial officer in helping, as you indicated, to improve the condition of the prison? What is their sentencing approach, their mindset? I know that you don't want to say that is needed here. It shouldn't be discussed. It shouldn't be a matter of their choice. And it has nothing to do with independence. It's got everything working together to ensure that they must be trained. Or that training is about bringing, making them aware of the responsibility of this department and their role in improving the condition of this department. So that's training, the training of the police that is also aimed at helping the entire system. I think in my mind, this is the area we need to really work together to deal with it. I know there's a view of the, that, I don't know if we take into account sufficient the matter that we are talking about. And I don't know, there's a lot of debate about this issue. I was following Sky News the other day. I see the former conservative leader of Britain, he's coming up with proposals to do away with stop sending in Britain. It's his view of dealing with overcrowding. You are concerned about the increase of long sending contributing to overcrowding. He's talked about short sending. He's got an idea to move away what the board is keeping this 6 months, 9 months, 1 year, and so on, and they go out, they come back again, instead of correcting and actually not bringing them free. You are talking about the issue of bail, which is a tricky issue, because you know, part of the bail actually is also is to secure the trial. Part of the role of the bail is to secure the trial, to make sure that after someone comes to trial, the trial takes place. But I agree with you that there needs to be clear dealing with that area of how the court actually deals with arrested persons. I don't want to debate about this issue, but I'm just saying that I think more than talking now, we need to move to the area where what are we actually going to do to make sure that there's a cluster approach, both in operation, in budgeting, policy in aligning the law.
Thank you. Mr. Flip, and then you'll respond to that, Mr. Flip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to start with the mandate of the Office of the Inspector Judge, and
25, states that the conditions and the treatment, and I want to focus specifically on the treatment of inmates. I see a very interesting picture emerging, and I'm talking about how the sequence of all the presentations we've been listening to by the department, by all the stakeholders. And I see the issue of treatment, and I want to specifically refer to the issue of litigation, that last year for the financial year there was 988 million rand paid out to litigants in relation to bodily harm and injury. Now, your job, Judge, is to look at the treatment of prisoners in prison. And I want to almost take the picture, complete the picture and the line and the link, as to whether you, and I notice your stats also around the number of complaints filed by activists, by independent visitors. The question I want to ask is, how do you deal with the whole issue of treatment in a very substantive way, in a way that when an IPV, when an inmate complains to an independent visitor, substantively, not just for reporting purposes, but to absolutely resolve that issue. And then I want to make a line further, because then you see unnatural death within our prisons, in our correctional centers. And I want to also ask that line, and I also go to the discrepancy, but I think Mr. Raga says that he's busy sorting out the discrepancy between the Department of Correctional Stats and your stats as an independent sector. And the question I'm asking almost is, are the placement of independent visitors at correctional centers at the local ground, are they stopping this kind of abuse of people's personal and bodily integrity? And I'm asking that specifically as we're raising, moving to Christmas, and we know that the emergency support teams or ESTs are coming up, and the spike, how increasing assaults is going to happen in prison. And what measures you are taking to, in a way, almost prevent those kinds of increase during December and January, which is a necessary for some theorem, you know, it's necessary to search and see the internet, because there's lots of samples that also to get rid of it, but not to necessarily compromise the bodily integrity of inmates. And I'm just asking it in that whole holistic context, Judge. The other question I quickly want to ask, and sorry, perhaps you can also link that to your mandatory week, because I just noticed a very interesting point about your test, and that is that transfers seems to be the highest at this point. And I also noticed that in relation to your mandatory report, very few internal disciplinary hearings are held at prison. So I almost kind of, by inference, like draw conclusions that when a guy complains, there's no internal process being established, they transfer the guy. Hasn't the time come where also all transfers must be reported to you as a mandatory kind of another mandatory, like forced, physical or use of force? Shouldn't they also, because we know the practice, when a guy complains, he gets transferred. Shouldn't people also report transfers to you as a matter of, as a mandatory kind of report? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Perhaps I should just deal with Mr. Fitz's question first, because it's very fresh in my mind. The whole question of transfers is something which has been bothering us, because it seems as if there are heads of centres who get rid of their problems by transferring them to other centres instead of taking disciplinary steps. We are, in fact, talking about the possibility of asking for an amendment of the Act to make provision for transfers to be reported to us, and to go even one step further, that a person who is transferred from one centre to another should have the right to appeal against that transfer to the Judicial Inspectorate, so that we can consider and then make it. Although we don't make rulings under normal circumstances, we do have the power to intervene in certain aspects. And this may be one of those powers of intervention where we can play a role. I think we have a power of intervention where there are segregations and the like. But this should perhaps be extended also to transfers. I think an abuse is being made by certain heads of centres. And what worries us also is that cases which are reported to us and complaints are raised by inmates cannot be properly dealt with because the people who are concerned have been transferred to another centre. And now suddenly you have to make use of another independent visitor at that centre to try and establish what's going on. So that is something which has caused us a lot of concern. As far as the question of our mandate is concerned and the treatment and the litigation, in fact, that's a topic that was discussed on Monday at this meeting in Pretoria. The whole question of litigation shouldn't be taking place. Far too much money is being spent because of wrongful detention, of wrongful treatment of people who are there. Now, the question is, to what extent can we become involved? Now, the stuff is all reported to us. We hear about this from our independent visitors. We also hear about it from other sources. We're grateful that the chairperson of the Sports Radio Committee has in fact also referred certain cases to us which we have been able to deal with immediately. Our powers, as the inspecting judge, I don't have the power I had when I was a judge of the High Court, I've now retired there, where I could simply go into a prison and make an order that this person must be removed immediately. There was nothing stopping me from doing that, and I did it on numerous occasions. For instance, I go to Rustenburg and I see Rustenburg Center up in Limpopo, or are they Mpumalanga? Are they Northwest? We were up there not too long ago, and there we had the situation of children who were being kept in the adult side of the center. And we were told that was just a mistake. Now, under normal circumstances, I would like to have given a ruling there and then an order just to say they must be placed into the children's section with immediate effect. And I want to see them being taken over. Now, that is the kind of situation where you have the difficulty is we report to the minister. And in fact, every report I get from these three judges who give me regular reports, I also send through to the minister. But the difficulty is it's difficult for us to establish whether there is a response to the report or to the recommendation. That is why we're very grateful that this Honourable Committee now has the opportunity to also consider every single report and then to ask whether there has been a response. Once again, we don't want to point fingers at anyone because I think the most important thing which Mr. Madata was referring to in his question relates to the importance of the cluster, the importance of total cooperation from all the parties. I'm not sure whether I've answered your whole question, but the substantive dealing with this problem is not all that easy because our powers are limited. But on the other hand, we do have the impression, and this is one of the topics I was discussing in a conference in Vienna just a week ago, where the whole question of reconciliation and reconciling and perhaps alternative dispute resolution in a correctional environment can take place. And we're also directing our training of independent visitors to the whole question of also becoming involved where possible with dealing with conflicts, resolution of conflicts. And our impression is that when we raise something during a visit with the head of center, almost invariably something is done about it there and then, without having to rely on the national commissioner or the regional commissioner or the area commissioner to deal with a matter. So that is one of the things that we really do look at is to see to what extent our independent visitors can already assist in dealing with and resolving conflicts, almost as a form of alternative dispute resolution. You don't have to bring in an attorney on a pro bono basis or someone else if your independent visitor is able to reconcile the parties. It's that kind of case. So that is happening. And certainly we're going to focus more on that in our whole training schedule are independent visitors. They aren't all lawyers, and they aren't clinical psychologists, but they can at least learn the basics of how to deal with that kind of matter and to see to what extent they can, in fact, assist in reconciling those conflicting interests. Mr. Madras, can I just move on to your question? Thank you very much, and thank you also for the kind words. As I mentioned right at the outset, I think the whole question of conditions prevailing in our centres should be widely interpreted. Because whatever the conditions and whatever the reason for the prevailing conditions, they are always going to have an effect on the treatment of the inmate. If the conditions are bad, if the management is poor, if there are irregularities, the people don't get proper feed, don't get sufficient food, if their ablution blocks, or if their sanitation and their showers, etc., are not sufficient for the purposes, all of that, and there might be various reasons for that, will certainly have an effect on the treatment of the inmates. So we like to see that we have a fairly wide function there. But once again, it's a reporting and it's an oversight function. Do we have the capacity to prevent human rights abuses? I think is a question that you asked, Mr. Madarsa. We can only report on those human rights abuses which we see, which we establish. I think there must be many, many that never come to our attention. Some people might feel intimidated. I think they have come to realize that the independent visitor is indeed independent of correctional services and correctional service officials. But it's a long and a slow process. Our office has only been functioning for the past 11 years. And it's a gradual process, but we do realize and we are aware of the fact that our relationship with correctional services has improved incredibly within that period. Initially, the office, it was like the family advocate. I was involved in the family advocate in the High Court in instituting the whole office of family advocate. My colleagues thought this is crazy. I don't need a family advocate to tell me what's in the best interest of children. Until they started hearing what kind of work the family advocate could do and what kind of assistance they could render. But it's the same now with the inspectorate. The inspectorate, via its heartbeat, via its independent visitors, is able to give assistance in fields where nobody ever thought it would be possible, and it is working. We can't prevent them, but at least we can hope that if our reports are acted upon, then they will diminish and eventually be addressed totally. IPVs are helping. The whole question of the issue of the judiciary. Now, this is something which is very close to me. The judiciary itself can't get the clusters together. You know, when I speak of, and I deal with that in the foreword, the role players are all the departments, starting with correctional services, and in fact, it starts with police. The moment the police arrest somebody and that person is within 48 hours brought before a magistrate, you have gone from police to justice and constitutional development. And only when a magistrate, a presiding officer, has been decided that this person must be detained pending further investigation, does correctional service come into the picture. Correctional services, in fact, has got no choice in the matter. The head of the center must accept whosoever is sent by Department of Justice, if I can put it that way, to the center, whether or not it's full, and whether or not they have sufficient facilities for that person. It's not like a hotel, you know, where you can say, no more room, sorry, all rooms full. So that kind of thing does happen. Our office is focused on the importance of, and this is really the answer to your question, Mr. Madarsa, has focused on the importance of a holistic approach. Total cooperation from all the role players, police, justice, correctional services, health, welfare, development, social social development. All these officers play together, but it's particularly those first three, and I know there are clusters who meet on a regular basis, representatives, but I'm not too sure how much they are achieving in the process, because we also have the case flow management meetings here, high courts and lower courts. We have stakeholders meetings. Mr. Rodney de Kock here, the Director of Public Prosecution, presides those. There are representatives of these, and there's a lot of talking done, but you're not too sure whether at the upper level, on a ministerial level, on the executive level, the same kind of discussion is taking place, and in fact there is an attempt to get all the parties to work together to achieve what we really all want. We want to live in a stable, harmonious society. We want justice and fairness to be done and to be seen to be done. And there you cannot do it on your own. We cannot do it on our own. We are absolutely dependent on the other role players. And when we tell the police gauge their success rate on the number of arrests they make, as opposed to the Department of Justice, which gauges the success on the number of convictions it secures, then you know there is a huge difference in approach. Because how many people are in fact arrested without justifiable reason? Now the Act, Section 29, I think it is, of the Criminal Procedure Act, it makes reference to how you effect an arrest and then under what circumstances. And throughout, reasonable suspicion, reasonableness is in fact the most basic criterion which is applied. I think that's basically the problem that you raised. We do need that kind of cooperation. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge. Mr. Abraham and then Mr. Palito.
Thank you very much, Chair. Thank you to the judge and the team for the presentation. The judge mentioned that there are excellent programs in some centers, but none in most. That's how I understood. Is it possible for the judge, not today, but to make available to us a list of those centers where the programs are acceptable, of an acceptable standard, and those where there are non-existent or where there's very little happening? The other issue was the hopelessly overcrowded conditions in various centers, and the fact that there are no eating utensils in some of them. Whether you could also, as a result of your interactions with these centers, inform us which centers have this kind of situation, especially where the basic duty of any correctional center is to provide food, shelter, and clothing. That's a basic, without that nothing else can happen. So we need to know which centers are these, where there's even a lack of basic things like the utensils to eat. Chairperson, then I noticed that on page 52, 53, and 54, I think Mr. Morris dealt with them, where he speaks about the unsustainability of the rate at which the budget of the department has been increasing. I mean, about 11 years ago, it was 3.5 billion, and it has now come right up to 13 billion. And the anticipation is that by 2012, which is roughly 2 years hence, it should increase to about 18 billion, and that is untenable. And you also make statements here about the, well, we now work out the ballpark figure as to what the current cost is per inmate, looking at the current budget, it gives me slightly over that's now this little computer, which is very rusty, slightly over 200 rand per inmate. That's what the cost is at the moment. Now, I also take note that there has been a steady decline in people, in inmates, being involved in activities, not recreational, but activities which can at least add value to their futures, as well as to self-sufficiency. And you give us a figure here of the number of inmates that were involved in agriculture, 6674 in 1997, and that has been reduced by 200% to 2210. Production workshops, 2359, all right, reduced by about 600. But still, this is a very disturbing thing. And have you perhaps been able to determine why this sort of trend has continued over the last 10, 11 years? And what needs to be done in order to see that there is an increased involvement and that we start producing many of the basic things that are required, ingredients that are required to cook food in the centers where the centers are situated in rural areas and where they have land. And what would your recommendation be or your suggestion be? Should be done in centers which are in city areas. I mean, whether there shouldn't be on the outskirts of towns and cities, land that the state should provide, where various forms of agricultural activity can take place, and provide a major degree of self-sufficiency. Finally, Chair, there have been some concerns in the report with regard to medical paroles. And that you say that awaiting trial prisoners are not considered for medical paroles whatsoever. That's how I understand it. Now, if that is the case, what is your suggestion? What needs to be done? You in your budget, you have reported spending the same amount in the financial year under question as the previous year. And could you perhaps tell us whether this means that there has been no increases for salaries in salaries for your employees? And does it also mean that there were no increases in the prices of commodities? And whether you could also tell us whether part of the reason for that same expenditure in 2 years is the fact that you have a staff complement, you had a staff complement in 2007-2008 of 66, and this has dropped in 2008-2009 to 49. Thank you very much.
That was a mouthful, but can I ask you to be very brief because there's at least three more that we want to contribute. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairperson. The whole question of medical parole is being very carefully looked at, perhaps I can just mention that. And I've been given to understand that a retired judge of the Supreme Court of Appeal has been asked to consider the whole question of the requirements for medical parole. We are concerned, obviously, about that. I've always said any form of indignity which a person is suffering should depending on the nature of the indignity, depending on the nature of the illness or disease from which he is suffering, shouldn't perhaps give rise to that. I'm not sure that we're in a position to give you a full answer on the whole question of medical parole. It is engaging the interest of the National Commission as well. I'd like, Mr. on the question of programs, facilities and activities, I'd like Mr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So Abraham, also on page 25, we deal with the issue of medical parole. If I could just add to the judge, and what we've found in our reading of the report is that in only 14% of the deaths that occurred last year, the inmates were actually considered for medical parole, and only in only 5.5% were they released. So it's clearly not up to standard, to understand it. It's clearly a lot must be done in that area. Going back to your request on those incentives with excellent programs, what we're planning for next year's annual report, which is due in only about 4 months, so we will table it very early in the new financial year, is to do a full audit of all the programs on offer at every correctional center. That we also include those programs on offer by NGOs and so on. And then what we could possibly do, Mr. Chair, with your permission, is to send through the information as we get it so that we can summarize it in the report, but so that the committee can also be informed on a continuous basis on our findings. Just by own experience, for instance, the programs run in some of the prisons for or the correctional centers for poverty alleviation. It's wonderful. At Boksburg, where they bake bread using inmate labor at about 3 rand a bread, and they distribute the surplus in the poorest of the poor of the local communities. The same with agriculture at Helderstrom. So there are many real success stories that we can build on. On the question of the eating utensils, in our annual report last year, we did a full audit of infrastructure. And in that report, we listed and we gave the detailed information of the unavailability of eating utensils. So what we'll do, Mr. Abrams, is I'll forward you a copy of that report, Mr. Chair, and then we'll also just update the information from our side. But it was given and done last year. We looked at it in much detail. Then in terms of the budget, as you said, 55, 53, and pages 54, in terms of the sustainability, I think it's really... It's come to a point where, Mr. Chair, from our own point of view, it is almost an ethical question. Now, we're spending more than 40 million rand a day on running our prisons. Consider the opportunity cost of that for our nation in terms of building schools and hospitals. And so the question is, how much should we be spending? When do we draw the line? Is it a continuous consumption of resources? And we understand, how do we balance those needs? So what we're saying, and if you look at the economic realities, the current economic recession, so I can get I would put my head on the block, as they said, correctional services will not get the budget that they asked for next year. And over the next 2 or 3 years, I do not foresee, of course, the fiscal policy of government, we've heard about loans being made by central government to finance, but I'm just worried that the sustainability of it is under serious threat. And we also know from only another own experience, but internationally as well, if the budget of correctional services must be cut, who's going to suffer first? It's the inmates. It's the thing that you see, the clothes, the medical treatment, and so in order for us to plan ahead, we have a bit of a window period now, and the best way for us to plan is to invest our money that we have now to create higher levels of sustainability. As you said, farms, and we've seen there are so many success stories. The private prisons, if I can use it, they have on an area the size of this room. They produce vegetables for almost the whole prison. So it is possible in terms of running. I remember reading about what the chair said in training inmates to maintain their own infrastructure, TVs. I think that's the kind of investment that we need to make. Lastly, the expenses, why you haven't seen an increase in our budget. Of course, it's a continuous competition for limited resources, because we get our budget from correctional services. We know that they are under severe pressure in terms of staff shortages and so on. So we are continuously competing with them in terms of resources. But also, Mr. Chair, that because of the fact that we have now for 3 years had only acting judges, our operations went into a kind of a limbo stage where we had Judge Erasmus as an acting judge. Although he was there for a 3-year term, his term was always just for 3 months at a time. So it was extended, the same with Judge Ekiso. So that's why, sir, if you look at our cost, we've maintained the status quo. With the new judge there now for a 3-year term, with the amendment of the new act, I think we can now plan ahead But it's also a strategic decision that this committee should also advise on. Do you expect the judicial inspectorate of becoming another government department? Maybe not. Maybe we should remain small, focus on reporting only, opposed to becoming another government department with 500-600 members of staff, etc. But it's a strategic decision, Mr. Chair. I'm not just putting it on the table. I thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chairperson. Unfortunately, I have to repeat that one. The last comment. For me, I want to know that how effective is this institution operating? Because if I heard that something right, it's that we only brought two regions in the whole country. So for me, this institution is too small. How effective. I want to know about the effectiveness of this service. What also confused me is the judge argument about the act, not the but if I have to make a recommendation, I would say leave that for public debate. Let the public debate domain debate them, then only judges and lawyers debating this, not including the public. Then I want to go to page 16, the second of over 1,000. Before I go to that one, I also like to know if it would be useful if the report could have also provided statistics of offenders who apply for medical parole and was not granted. The overcrowding trend that the report has stated here, this institution is 11 years down the line. I would have liked to see that the report has also stipulated some recommendations of how are we going to resolve this. There must be mechanisms as we put in place long ago to address this question of overcrowding, not to compare ourselves with other countries, most countries in the world, but us as South Africa have our own model that we have, our own model and our successful model of looking at how do we overcome this overcrowding. Because it is hygienically and human, if we talk about hygiene of people, human dignity and read this report of the overcrowding, the circumstances under which people are incarcerated, then you can imagine how, why this country is getting more violently and more violent, because people are not rehabilitated in this correctional center effectively. I also look at state 17 as a norm. The recommendation of the then committee that was there of Department of Public Works, Treasury and Prison Services. For me, nothing has been done to change the recommendation of this committee years ago. Nothing has been done yet. I can't see any effort that was made to help us out of this situation, out of a recommendation that was made years ago, and there were no changes. We are 15 years down the line, but there are no changes. It's just a report, and we will get the report next year again. It will just have slightly changes. It would be the very same report if this was the practice of 11 years ago. And also, at page 19, the number of unsentenced and or awaiting trial inmates.
I would have liked to know, can you give us a list of what are the real complaints that can be addressed immediately regarding this unsentenced and awaiting trial detainees? I heard that what my honorable Madasa said about the clusters and all those stuff, but this is an independent institution. Independently so, it could have had big to fight. And to help us out of this overcrowding situation, because it is really unbearable. And the question of the mismanagement, I also can't see any. I cannot see any recommendations that lead us to really biting. Is that bite aggressive steps taken for this mismanagement that are reported here in this report? I also want to know about the JIOP being audited. Is this report being audited by the Auditor General? If so, where is the auditor from? If no, why not? I think we should.
Judge, I think I'll just deal with the question of the amendments. Please don't misunderstand me. The suggestion was made by Professor Sulikio when he was here earlier in his capacity as member of the National Commission that a judge in a court case had obiter, that means en passant, in passing, had made a comment about the act. Now, I didn't read that. I don't know what he said. I don't know what part of the act he was dealing with. And I think it's a very unwise kind of remark to make about an act in general if you have a problem with one or two provisions in it. I had over the 23, 24 years I've been a judge, I had plenty of problems with legislation. But the mere fact that you might have a problem with one or two provisions doesn't mean the whole act must be scrapped. That's what I'm saying. So before you decide that the whole act must be rewritten, just establish what that judge says, what his problem is, and then deal with the real issues which have arisen over the years. And I'm not particularly persuaded by what I heard earlier today. On the other questions, I'd like to ask Mr. Morris just to respond.
Thank you, Mr.
Prodisha.
In terms of the effect of the organization, I think it's a real challenge to us as well. And I just want to use the concept there, Mr. Chair, of value creation, is that as soon as the more we can align our services to the needs that exist in this committee, probably we'll become more efficient. Now, the chapter in the report that deals with the judicial inspector, we have listed a number of challenges facing us in terms of efficiency, and those are listed, if I could just briefly... On pages 50, we've made a number of recommendations. Of course, we're careful of putting for your consideration a one-dimensional solution, a quick fix. I think there's a number of issues that we need to continuously engage in and see how do we improve our efficiencies. But now, for us also to get feedback from you in terms of our inefficiencies or the problems would be very, very valuable. And that's why we really appreciate an opportunity like this so that we can interact with you as a very important role player, even more so probably the shareholders of this organization on that basis. If I may go on the question of medical parole, on page 25 we gave some stats, man, in terms of medical parole, and also on page where we deal with the complaints, if somebody can just help me. We've listed last year, page 36. Sorry, Mr. Chair, I'm running through that. You'll see there on page 36, it's all the number of complaints we received from inmates. And we received 764 inmates complain to us about
medical release. And in those cases, only 5% of them were granted medical parole at the end of the day. So you can see there's a massive gap between the, and we don't have the powers to grant it. We can simply report, we can simply facilitate the process on how it's followed. And we see this report bringing back and reporting to you about the inefficiencies in the system, not as a name and shame exercise, but rather as information that will enable you as the legislator to look at a solution to the problem. So we received many, ma'am. If you look at this, 764, and you take that there's about 900 people that died, then we had about 80% of them complaining about being released on non-medical grounds. And we only know that in 14% those applications were considered by the parole board before people died, and in only 5% they were actually released. So it's a systemic problem. We need to look at how can we fix that. Then in terms of your request on the recommendations on overcrowding, we tried to make some recommendations on page 22. And we see, for instance, the immediate release of all awaiting trial inmates with unaffordable bail. In September 2000, Cabinet approved such an exercise. And as a result, 9,000 people were released immediately. And these are the people that the court considered not to pose any threat to the community. And they were in prison simply because they were too poor to pay their bail of 100 or 200, or in that case, less than 1,000 rand. And then there's a number of other suggestions also that the police should seriously reconsider the key performance indicator being the number of arrests. You understand that? But again, these recommendations we made from our own perspective. We appreciate that there are many other different perspectives, and we know that there's many other inputs. So that we put it on the table for debate and within the minister's cluster and so on. Judge, just lastly from my side, and the Auditor General, ma'am, we are not listed as a public entity in the Public Finance Management Act, Chapter 3. We don't have our own accounting officer or our own budget. We form part of the budget of correctional services. So the Auditor General do not audit us separately. They audit the department as a whole. We would welcome any audits. We do receive internal audits done from correctional services from time to time. We use all these systems, like PASL and BAS and so, although we use it, we run it totally independent. Meaning if we need to make payments of IPVs, a head of prison is not involved in it at all. It's totally dealt with independently, but we use their systems. Otherwise, it was going to cost us millions of rands to create our own infrastructure. So it's a kind of a bit of a piggyback on the department. Thank you.
Chairperson, can I just add something on the question which was placed by was put by the honourable member? That what mechanisms do you say can be used, you know, to address this whole question of overcrowding? Now, our office has been busy with this overcrowding problem since 2000. Judge Hannes Fagan, who was at that time judge, in fact, focused virtually all his attention on the question of overcrowding. Our functioning in terms of our mandate is not to deal with that kind of thing. We deal with conditions. Overcrowding creates a condition. When we speak of possibilities of plea bargaining, of people getting involved, of people going out on bail, we are in fact interfering to a certain extent with the functioning of other departments. What we are trying to do, however, is not to interfere with what police are doing and with what the Department of Justice is doing relating to bail and plea bargaining, etc., etc., or correctional supervision sentences. What we are looking at is perhaps helping to facilitate or even mediate some kind of a solution to this problem. And once again, that brings me back to our whole big problem. Until such time as all the role players, in this case, these various departments, but also other role players, work together to try and achieve that, no single department, and certainly not the Judicial Inspectorate, will be able to address the question of overcrowding. It has to be a combined, concerted effort to address something which has really become a huge problem. Throughout the world, incidentally, it's not just a South African problem. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. let me thank the judge and the team for their presentation. I want to go straight to the independent visitor. They paid a total visit, a total of 7,103 visits to correctional center, and in the process interviewed 344,207 inmates and recorded a total of 69 of blah 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 complaints. However, the report can confuse us in which way. If it states that 344,257 inmates were interviewed, since in South Africa we have only 165,000 inmates. The report, according to me, the report was supposed to explain how it came to this number, which prismatic included a multiple interviews with the same offender or interviews with new offenders that continuously enter the system. Number two, the issue of unnatural death at the hands of officials, it is a big concern for this committee. For an example, 9 inmates in KZN and 3 inmates in Eastern Cape were killed by the officials. What are the main causes of these unnatural deaths? You should have categorized them. And one other thing, Chairperson, that was not touched, is an issue of HIV and AIDS in prison and gangsterism in prison as a problem that was raised by the head of Senders in the previous report. I thank you, Chairperson.
The number of complaints of course is frequently repetitious. It's not new people are raising new complaints. Frequently the same person might raise any number of complaints. These are the statistics that we receive in a 200-word report which is submitted to us once a month by each and every independent visitor. And we base it on what they tell us. Any complaint, however trivial, is in fact reported by them. And that is the instruction which is given to them. That's the first thing. As far as the question of unnatural death and categorizing, in many cases, you must remember we're not a court of law. What we do is we establish that there's been an unnatural death, and we ask, and it's something which has to be reported on, if there is some indication of liability, culpability, on the part of some or other party, we will mention that there are indications of culpability on the part of, say, correctional services officials. But we do not try to give legal opinions on whether or not anybody is liable for the death. In most cases, there is immediately an internal investigation. We are given those internal investigations. If we're not satisfied with what we read there, we investigate, make our own investigation. The Act makes provision for that. In many cases, you say categorized, they would, depending on what the charge is, if we believe that it looks like murder, we will then refer this to the department, we will report to the minister, and then we accept that it's going to be that the necessary charges will be laid by the Department of Justice, by the prosecutorial arm. But that is something, once again, which is beyond our powers. We don't take it that step further. We simply establish whether or not the death has been unnatural, whether there are indications of culpability, and to what extent that is then carried through is in the hands of the correctional authorities and, of course, justice authorities. And then as far as HIV and AIDS is concerned, that has been causing me personally huge problems, because you have the situation, you know, up to today we've had 940 deaths. The last indication I got here was today, death number 940 since the beginning of the year, which takes us to about at least 100 deaths a month. Now, frequently we hear, it might be a youngster in a juvenile center. Why? Was that person already infected with HIV/AIDS? Because we know that many of these early deaths may be attributed to HIV/AIDS. But we don't know whether these people, at what stage it's been identified by the prison authorities. Whether the person was already an HIV/AIDS candidate when he came into prison but didn't want to say so. And whether or not he or she was taking medication, but the authorities didn't realize that this person must be receiving medication, and that's the reason why the person died. So there are many aspects. That's where we say the Department of Health must come into the picture, and where it might be necessary to insist in the interest of all the inmates of a particular correctional center that every person who is admitted should be subjected to a full medical examination. At the moment, that's not the case. And that is why, I mean, we had a case of somebody being transferred from Rooikrans to Leeuwkop. And the authorities at Rooikrans said it's because they didn't have the facilities to look after this very, very ill person, terminally ill. The Leeuwkop people didn't know what was going on. They had no idea why the person was being transferred. Somewhere along the line, it was a total lack of communication. So those are things which do happen and can happen. It is a huge problem, and it is something which we believe should be addressed, whether it be by legislation or whether it be by policy decisions, but certainly it is a problem which cannot be. On gangsterism, I think I can tell you that to a large extent, gangsterism has not become minimal, but it doesn't play the same kind of role as it did previously. When I did that long faggot case of 2 years, 10 years ago, gangsterism was rife. But I think to a large extent it doesn't play the same kind of role. It might well be that a gangster, so-called gangster head, decides that this new inmate must become his or her partner, and he or she infects this person with AIDS. And that can happen. But unfortunately, one doesn't have control over that kind of situation. Frequently, the damage is done before you even know about it. Thank you.
Mam Nyaga?
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm sorry, I'm going to go back to the question of natural my concern is that I had the presenter saying when the district surgeon go to the mortuary for the post-mortem, he comes out with a certificate that is going to say natural death. But my concern is that why only inmates all natural, because there's hypertension, diabetes, meningitis, and all this I can call heart failure. Why only prisoners all natural death? My question, what I want to ask, are these inmates, when they are supposed to have that post-mortem, are the families involved to come and watch the post-mortem, or only just because it's an inmate, the post-mortem must go on like that, and the surgeon will come out with the certificate that is going to say natural death or whatever. It's a concern because the number here is 1,555 that's reported in 2008. But until up to now, we don't know from January until up to now what is the total number of the natural deaths in the prison. That is my only question.
Thank you very much. We're running late, so we'll afford you an opportunity to respond and then if there's any closing remarks. But I just wanted to ask a question. You know, somebody indicated earlier on about stakeholders meetings, where
nominated and or I would assume her own board. I don't know about my colleagues, but I am very active in my constituency. I've never heard of a stakeholders meeting in my constituency. Never heard of a stakeholders meeting in New Clare, Riverlea, Bosmont, that area where my constituency is. So could you see, because part of your concern is that these stakeholders meetings are not funded or you don't get a system. There are MPs here that I'm sure would go to stakeholders meetings every day if they knew where they were. So it's more a request that if you involve MPs, I'm sure we'd go and support these stakeholders meetings. But I can assure you that in the past 10 years, I've never heard of one stakeholder meeting in my constituency. It's just a comment that I thought I should bring up. And if you wish to, you can comment on that, plus on the matter raised by Honorable Nyanda.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairperson, Honorable Members. May I just deal with the matter you raised there, the whole question of stakeholder meetings? That was what Mr. Charles mentioned in his part of the presentation. And I think Mr. Carlos would be in the best position to explain to us what kind of stakeholder meetings he has and why then, as you say, it doesn't happen in your case. But before I get there, can I just deal with a special unnatural death question by Ms. Nyanda? When I came into this office a year and a half ago, one of the things that bothered me was the number of deaths. They were all regarded as natural because they are natural causes. The medical doctor who certifies the death says it's natural causes. And the end of story. But then, when you go into the picture, it seems that something which is ostensibly a natural cause can in fact be unnatural. And yet, this is something where you have, it's almost a gut feeling, where you have to decide whether this is something which must be further investigated. And in fact, I requested the legal services unit to go into all those cases to establish. And post-mortems have only been held in unnatural deaths. The question which has arisen is, shouldn't we have post-mortems in all cases where there is a death? The presence or the absence of family members is not, to me, the important thing, with great respect. The important thing is we are concerned that deaths which are regarded as natural and are certified as natural are in fact not natural. And that requires special attention. We're only, I think, at the very start of what could become a much larger problem, but at least I think we have identified that this can do. And the Health Act makes provision for cases which are ostensibly natural, where there are natural causes. In fact, the death is regarded as unnatural because of circumstances. An intermediate who comes into the picture doesn't give you your medication. That person could be the reason why you die, and that probability. So it is something we are looking at very seriously, and we'll give you assurance that this committee will be fully apprised of any kind of findings that we do make in this regard. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Carl, also could talk about the question of these stakeholders.
Mr. Chair, your points are well taken. We have discovered two aspects that we have changed in the system. Firstly, a permanent staff member was the chairperson of the Visitors Committee. And that person going out to that monthly meeting did not know all the organizations and role players within that specific community. So we've changed that system where it's not a permanent staff member that is the chairperson, but that the independent visitors elect their own chairperson that can obviously play a much bigger role in terms of identifying stakeholders, role players in that community. Secondly, we've also identified that all the monthly visitors committee meetings are held at the same place in your bigger centers and places.
meaning that all meetings and stakeholder meetings is only at that specific place. So we only recently started with the idea of rotating those meetings to also accommodate other smaller areas and places. So yes, you are eminently correct that there was a lack. We have identified it, we've addressed it, and I am 100% sure that within our next report, we will definitely be able to say that we have overcome those gaps that we have identified. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. I have a suggestion which suggests that all public representatives at least be talked, because we need buy-in from community, especially with the reintegration program. Councillors in every ward, so I'm sure you can do that. We want to end, but respecting that, I requested, you know, I received a report last week about a death in Pretoria. And I asked them to ask you to give us some feedback, if indeed you had any feedback on it. Do you have any feedback on a death? The report that I received on the telephone was that inmate was killed by official. Is there any report? Carlson will be able to advise you on that, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, yes, we received the request to go and do an inspection before we do an investigation, just to follow up on the allegations. What we have found is that we have sent one of our inspectors the very same day that we received the request. What we have found is that there was only, for the last 3 months, two deaths, specifically at Pretoria Local, where the request came from. That specific death took place on the 28th of October. It was not an inmate that died that specific day. It was an ex-offender. What happened, just to summarize it, is that the department discovered that there was some illegal dealings with drugs, specifically drugs. And then one of the inmates came with the information and explained how the drugs come into the center. So on that specific date, on the 28th, at 1 o'clock in the morning, the person, the ex-offender, came, and he was on the premises of DCS. That he was found, and it is alleged that shots was fired, not at the ex-offender himself, but he was on, according to the report, on the door, on a wall, climbing over the wall, and in the process, he fell off the wall and he died. He was taken to the hospital, and he actually died at the hospital. So the fact of the matter is, this was not an offender at that stage, an ex-offender. It was not inside the correctional center, but on the premises on the correctional center. So that is what the fact that we gathered. We did give the report through to the judge, and the judge did give us direction on the way forward how to deal with it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So I mentioned in this regard, Mr. Chairperson, it's true that it's an ex-offender, but as far as we're concerned, and this is once again my fairly wide interpretation of conditions, in a center. If authorities or the officials in the center shoot at anybody, he falls off a wall. I don't know whether he died of wounds, gunshot wounds. I don't know whether he died because of injuries sustained when he fell off the wall. But I am concerned that it should be necessary to make use of firearms to apprehend a person under these circumstances. So as far as I'm concerned, we've only started this investigation, and we'd like to know far more about it. It's been suggested that it's beyond our mandate, but I believe that it does have a bearing on the conditions in that particular centre, and as such, I've given instructions that the matter be further examined. I want a post-mortem report on the exact reasons for the death of that person, and then a full investigation of where he was on the premises and what he was doing there, and what actions and reactions took place. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We won't get involved in whether it's a mandate or not. Ms. Reiner, can you submit a preliminary report to this one? We received a telephone call from one of your officials indicating that somebody has been killed at Victoria Central now. Let's not get involved in whose turf it is. So if you could give us a report. I mean, I'm listening to the story. It happened at 1 o'clock in the morning. It was an ex-offender getting over the wall. The obvious question is, if I could get over the wall going in, how many people can get over the wall coming out of the cement? We can't wait until another escape before we react. So just give us a preliminary report on that. Thank you very much. We were hoping to do a bit more as a committee, but unfortunately we've got 2 minutes before lunchtime. We will postpone. Sorry, Cindy. Thank you very much. Our next engagement is on the 11th. And to the inspecting judge and his team, thank you very much for helping or being here with us.